Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
I don't know if now is the time, but there's something that Ellison himself wrote about the structure of this. I mean, I've sort of alluded to the form. I don't know, should I hold off on that, Gus, and see if we have time? Or?
Feel free. Go ahead and share.
Yeah. He says, an interviewer is asking Ralph Ellison, did you have everything thought out before you began to write Invisible Man? Ellison says, the symbols and their connections were known to me. I began it with a chart of a three-part division. It was a conceptual frame with most of the ideas and some of the incidents indicated. The three parts represent the narrator's movement from purpose to passion to perception. So again, there's that idea of the victory of conscious perception, that it's moves from purpose to passion to perception. There's the three parts to it. These three major sections are built of smaller units of three, which mark the course of the action and which depend for their development upon what I hoped was a consistent and developing motivation. And I'll say, you know, when I read the book, I didn't immediately see that it was a three-part structure, that each of those three parts had another three parts to it. But, I mean, it really speaks to the completeness of Ellison's vision, that each part links to the next part. I think the experience is one very much of consistent developing motivation, but it's just so beautifully fulfilled in this perfectly symmetrical form that he conceived. He says, you'll note that the maximum insight on the hero's part isn't reached until the final section. After all, it's a novel about innocence and human error, a struggle through illusion to reality. Each section begins with a sheet of paper. Each piece of paper is exchanged for another and contains a definition of his identity, or the social role he is to play as defined for him by others. But all say essentially the same thing, keep this boy running. Before he could have some voice in his own destiny, he had to discard these old identities and illusions. His enlightenment couldn't come until then. Once he recognizes the hole of darkness into which these papers put him, he has to burn them. That's the plan and the intention. And I just think that that's such a beautiful kind of snapshot of the whole experience. You know, again, I didn't get it, you know, just reading the book, like, but it was just such a powerful thing for me when I read that quote. I said, wow, he really structured it so that every part of the novel begins and ends with a piece of paper that is exchanged for another. And each one of these pieces of paper is about trying to give the Invisible Man an identity other than his true human identity. And the culmination is in the burning of all of those papers. But it's also the culmination is then in the writing of this book. This book is, from beginning to end, about the power of words, about the power of written words and printed words, about the power of various scripts. And what Ellison finally asserts, he's got a character that is driven from beginning to the end of the book by these pieces of paper that are being handed to him. And finally, he burns them in exchange for them, or as a replacement for him. He's going to assert himself as an author and produce his own written words. And I just think that that's such a powerful fulfillment of the whole structure of the experience here. And it just kind of gave me a different appreciation for it to to know that that is how he conceived of it. He does very clearly signal that the importance of that when he sort of near the end of the book, he does give you the inventory of all of those people, pieces of paper, and gives you the retrospective of what they have meant. But anyhow, I think it's more powerful if you've worked your way through and you get to that and you can and see how it all has fit together and how one sort of great victory of perception is going to see through all the consistency of what has driven him throughout the book.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, July 27th, 2018. So I have been told, oh, sad day. Last study session on Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man. It has been spectacular. I'm so glad that this is right there with medical apartheid. Obviously, this is fiction and medical apartheid, painful nonfiction, but equally satisfying to have read both of these books with the Cows listeners. Wow. What a privilege, an honor, a pleasure it has been the past few weeks. Oh, so sad. But Zora Neale Hurston, next Friday, it's not like the book club is wrapping up. But man, oh man, I have enjoyed the text. So that was Dr. Martin Kevorkian, his visit in 2010, August 7th, 2010. Has it been 8 years? Where he, I think, gave some great details to ponder as we finish up chapter 25 and the epilogue. I was able to ask Dr. Kevorkian a number of questions since last Friday's reading about some of the things that came up. He responded. I'm going to read what he had to say about responsibility because that's something that I asked. I encouraged listeners to go back and reread the prologue because that's where we're going to be ending the book, loops, boomerangs back, if you will, to where it started, where the narrator basically said, let me tell you a story about, you know, how I became less confused. So that's what we're going back to today. So I encouraged folks, go back, reread the prologue. I did that. In fact, I re-listened to Joe Morton narrate the prologue, which was, well, bravo to Joe Morton. Bravo. Wow. What a performance. A text that is absolutely stellar that I've read many times. This is my first time hearing an audiobook of Invisible Man. And whew, what can I say? Spectacular performance from Mr. Joe Morton. He added immensely to my enjoyment of reading and thinking about the text. Anyway, so I went back, listened to the prologue again, and the term responsibility is so prominently featured there, more so than any other place in the text. And I just really thinking about what is Ellison getting at with the word responsibility? What does he want us to think about? And particularly, how does his use of the term responsibility evolve throughout the text? So I asked Dr. Kevorkian about this term. This is how he responded. Your question about responsibility really got me wondering. I checked and I see that the word responsibility or irresponsibility at the beginning appears 26 times in the novel and is frequently repeated for emphasis in key scenes, as you also note. I think that the word responsibility is sometimes used as a kind of trap or limitation, that the narrator experiences it as a concept that is used to keep him in his place. I think it is used in contradictory ways, which makes sense given that he is confronting a system of racism that is stacked against him, and by the end of the book, he is trying to figure out a way to lay claim to the word in a way that does not trap him in the ways that the men at the Battle Royal and in the Brotherhood do, as they seek to deny him equality and to deny him freedom. In both cases, these white men seem to use responsibility to impose a kind of discipline on him. The clearest example, and the one that I remembered, was in the Battle Royal. He has been talking about social responsibility as the audience encourages him, but then they become very upset when he uses another phrase he has heard, social equality. I took that to mean that they are okay when he seems to be talking about responsibility in the sense of knowing that he needs to behave in a way that keeps him in line and also does not implicate or blame anyone else for his outcomes. But when he says social equality, suddenly he is seen to be threatening the system of racism itself. Suddenly, responsibility would not be one-sided. Equality would make white men and white women responsible for acknowledging and treating him and non-whites as equals. In the context of the brotherhood, responsibility, and especially personal responsibility, takes on a different value, but still one that is used against him. Whereas the rich men at the Battle Royal seem to be operating on an ideology of individualism, and thus they want the narrator to take responsibility for himself in a way that does not place any blame on them. The Brotherhood is all about taking the party line and denying authority to the individual. The narrator, in backtracking, has to say that he got personal responsibility from the committee. For the men at the Battle Royal, the narrator's talk of responsibility is fine as long as it does not involve laying claim to equality. For the men at the Brotherhood, the narrator's talk of responsibility is not fine because they see him acting freely outside of their authority. As near as I can figure out, the novel ends on a note that responsibility needs to be considered in a larger, more encompassing historical context, one that doesn't blame the individual non-white for the conditions of inequality, but one that also does not deny him the freedom to exercise personal responsibility in speaking up for and acting upon the truth. The narrator puzzles a lot over what his grandfather had said, but one of his final thoughts about what the grandfather may have meant was that we, through no fault of our own, were linked to all the others in the loud, clamoring, semi-visible world, that world seen only as a fertile field for exploitation by Jack and his kind, with condescension by Norton and his. One way of understanding that interpretation is to see that the victims of racism are not responsible for their place in the system, one that exists through no fault of our own, but that may be a different responsibility in the form of being linked, still exists, and that the perception of that linkage could be the basis for acting in ways different that work to evade the exploitation, do what we say at the Brotherhood, and condescension, insistence on inequality at the Battle Royal. Of the Jacks and Nortons of the system. At the beginning of the novel, the narrator prepares us to understand responsibility as a kind of trap and maybe a paradox, at least as presented by the confusing world into which he has been hurled. That is, he claims that he is irresponsible because responsibility depends upon being recognized. As long as he is in a system in which he is invisible, in which he is denied humanity, he cannot be responsible, at least within the terms dictated by that system, the terms insisted upon by the men at the Battle Royal. But in telling his story, the narrator, I think, is claiming a personal responsibility as a truth teller by observing the system and refusing its contradictory terms, the contradiction that he must accept responsibility for his own difficult situation, but that he cannot exercise responsibility to change it on his own initiative. I'm going to read that one more time. The contradiction that he must accept responsibility for his own difficult situation, but that he cannot exercise responsibility to change it on his own initiative. Commentary on the term responsibility. He also gave a response about Brother Restrum, what his name means, but I'll share that after we finish the book. So, with a bit of sadness, we will get to the final installment, Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man. We're picking up, we are about midway in chapter 25. So this is right after he said to Mary's, there's a brief breakage in the writing, and then it picks up. And this is in the big riot scene, as it or so-called riot, as it has been continuing. He says tussle with Ross, the exhorter, and it's continuing with the big showdown in Harlem. Context of white supremacy, audio segment number one.
There were rows of iron fences backed by low hedges before the houses, and I stumbled behind one and lay panting to rest from the crushing force of the water. But hardly had I settled down, the dry, dog-day smell of the hedge in my nose, when they stopped before the house, leaning upon the fence. They were passing a bottle around, and their voices sounded spent of strong emotions.
"This is some night," one of them said. "Ain't this some night?"
"Is about like the rest."
"Why you say that?"
"'Cause it's full of fucking and fighting and drinking and lying. Give me that bottle."
"Yeah, but tonight I seen some things I never seen before."
"You think you seen something? Hell, you ought to have been over on Lenox about 2 hours ago. You know that stud Ross the Destroyer? Well, man, he was spitting blood."
"That crazy guy?"
"Hell yes, man. He had him a big black horse and a fur cap and some kind of old lion skin or something over his shoulders, and he was raising hell. God damn if he wasn't a sight, riding up and down on this old horse, you know. One of the kind that pulls vegetable wagons. And he got him a cowboy saddle and some big spurs."
"Oh, no, man."
"Hell yes, riding up and down the block yelling, 'Destroy him, drive him out, burn him out. Ah, Ross commands you.' 'You get that man,' he said. 'Ah, Ross commands you. You destroy them to the last piece of rotten fish.' And about that time, some joker with a big old Georgia voice sticks his head out the window and yells, 'Ride him, cowboy! Give him hell and bananas!' And the man, that crazy son of a bitch, up there on that horse looked like death eating a sandwich. He reaches down and comes up with a .45 and starts blazing up at that window. And man, talk about cutting out. Ooh! In a second, wasn't nobody left but old Ross up there on that horse with that lion skin stretched straight out behind him. Crazy, man. Everybody else trying to get some loot, and him and his boys out for blood." I lay like a man rescued from drowning, listening, still not sure I was alive.
"I was over there,"
another voice said.
"You see him when the mounted police got after his ass?"
"Hell no. Here, take a little taste."
"Well, that's when you should have seen him. When he seen them cops riding up, he reached back of his saddle and come up with some kind of old shield."
"A shield?"
"Hell yes. One with a spike in the middle of it. And that ain't all. I mean, when he sees the cops, he calls one of his goddamn henchmen to hand him up a spear, and a little short guy run out into the street, and he give him one. You know, one of the kind you see them African guys carrying in the moving pictures."
"Where the hell was you, man?"
"Me? I'm over on the side where some stud done broke into a store and is selling cold beer." "Out the window, done going into business, man."
The voice laughed.
"I was drinking me some Budweiser and digging the doings when here come the cops up the street riding like cowboys, man." "And when old Rossin, what's his name, sees him and lets out a roar like a lion and rears way back and starts shooting spurs in that horse's ass just as fast as nickels falling in the subway at going home time." Goddamn, that's when you ought to see him. "Say, give me a taste of that there, fella." "Thanks." "He comes, boogity boogity, with that spear stuck out in front of him and that shield on his arm charging, man."
And he's yelling something in African or West Indian or something. And he's got his head down low like he knew about that shit, too, man. He's riding like Earl Sand in the Fifth at Jamaica. That old black horse let out a whinny and got his head down. I don't know where he got that son of a bitch. But, gentlemen, I swear, when he felt that steel in his high behind, he came on like man of war going to get his ashes hauled. Before the cops knowed what hit him, Ross is right in the middle of him. And one cop grabbed for that spear. And old Ross swung around and bust him across his head. And the cop goes down and his horse rears up. And old Ross rears his and tries to spear him another cop. And the other horse is just plunging around. And old Ross tries to spear him still another cop. Only he's too close. And the horse is pooting and snorting and pissing and shitting. And it swings around, and the cop is swinging his pistol. And every time he swings it, old Ross throws up his shield with one arm and chops at him with the spear with the other. And man, you could hear that gun striking that old shield like somebody dropping tire irons out a 12-story window. And you know what? When old Ross saw that he was too close to spear him a cop, he wheeled that horse around, and he rode off a bit. And did him a quick round about face and charged him again. Alpha blood, man. Only this time, the cops got tired of that bullshit, and one of them started shooting. And that was the lick. Old Ross didn't have time to get his gun, so he let fly that spear, and you could hear him grunt and say something about the cops' kinfolks, and then him and that horse shot up the street, leaping like hi-ho to goddamn silver. Man, where'd you come from? It's the truth, man. Here's my right hand. They were laughing outside the hedge and leaving, and I lay in a cramp, wanting to laugh, and yet knowing that Ross was not funny. Or not only funny, but dangerous as well. Wrong, but justified. Crazy, and yet coldly sane. Why did they make it seem funny? Only funny, I thought. And yet, knowing that it was funny. And dangerous. And sad. Jack had seen it, or had stumbled upon it, and used it to prepare a sacrifice. And I had been used as a tool. Oh, my grandfather had been wrong about yesing them to death and destruction. Or else, things had changed too much since his day. There was only one way to destroy them. I got it from behind the hedge in the waning moon, wet and shaken in the hot air, and started out looking for Jack, still turned around in my direction. I moved into the street listening to the distant sounds of the ride and seeing in my mind the image of two eyes in the bottom of a shattered glass. I kept to the darkest side of the streets and to the silent areas, thinking that if he wished really to hide his strategy, he'd appear in the district, with a sound truck perhaps, playing the friendly advisor with Restrum and Tobit beside him. They were in civilian clothes, and I thought, cops. Until I saw the baseball bat and started to turn, hearing, "Hey, you!" I hesitated. "What's in a briefcase?" they said. And if they'd asked me anything else, I might have stood still. But at the question, a wave of shame and outrage shook me, and I ran, still heading for Jack. But I was in a strange territory now, and someone, for some reason, had removed the manhole cover, and I felt myself plunge down, down, a long drop that ended upon a load of coal that sent up a cloud of dust, and I lay in the black dark upon the black coal, no longer running, hiding or concerned, hearing the shifting of the coal as from somewhere above their voices came floating down. "You see the way he went down? Zoom! I was just fixing to slug the bastard. You hit him? I don't know. Say, Joe, you think the bastard's dead? Maybe. He's sure in the dark, though. You can't even see his eyes. Nigging a coal pile, eh, Joe?" someone hollered down the hole. "Hey, black boy, come on out. We want to see what's in that briefcase." "Come down and get me," I said. "What's in that briefcase?" "You," I said, suddenly laughing. "What do you think of that?" "Me? All of you," I said. "You're crazy," he said. "But I still have you in the briefcase." "What'd you steal?" "Can you see?" I said. "Light a match." "What the hell's he talking about, Joe?" "Strike a match, the boogie's nuts." High above, I saw the small flames sputter into light. They stood, heads down, as in prayer, unable to see me back in the coal. "Come on down," I said. "I've had you in my briefcase all the time, and you didn't know me then, and you can't see me now." "You son of a bitch," one of them called, outrage. Then the match went out, and I heard something fall softly upon the coal nearby. They were talking above. You goddamn black nigger son of a bitch, someone called. See how you like this? And I heard the cover settle over the manhole with a dull clang. Fine bits of dirt showered down as they stamped upon the lid, and for a moment I sent Cole sliding in wild surprise, looking up through the black space to where for a second the dim light of a match sank through a circle of holes in the steel. Then I thought, this is the way it's always been. Only now I know it. And rested back, calm now, placing the briefcase beneath my head. I could open it in the morning, push off the lid. Now I was tired, too tired, my mind retreating, the image of the two glass eyes running together like blobs of melting lead. Here it was, as though the riot was gone, and I felt the tug of sleep seemed to move out upon black water. It's a kind of death without hanging, I thought. A death alive. In the morning, I'll remove the lid. Mary. I should have gone to Mary's. I would go now to Mary's in the only way that I could. I moved off over the black water, floating, sighing, sleeping invisibly. But I was never to reach Mary's, and I was over-optimistic about removing the steel cap in the morning. Great invisible waves of time flowed over me, but that morning never came. There was no morning nor light of any kind to awaken me, and I slept on and on until finally I was aroused by hunger. Then I was up in the dark and blundering around, feeling rough walls and the cold giving way beneath each step like treacherous sand. I tried to reach above me, but found only space, unbroken and impenetrable. Then I tried to find the usual ladder that leads out of such holes, but there was none. I had to have a light, and now on hands and knees, holding tight to my briefcase, I searched the coal until I found the folder of matches the men had dropped. How long ago had that been? But there were only three, and to save them I started searching for paper to make a torch, feeling about slowly over the coal pile. I needed just one piece of paper to light my way out of the hole, but there was nothing. Next, I searched my pockets, finding not even a bill or an advertising folder or a Brotherhood leaflet. Why had I destroyed Reinhardt's throwaway? Well, there was only one thing to do if I was to make a torch. I'd have to open my briefcase. In it were the only papers I had. I started with my high school diploma, applying one precious match with a feeling of remote irony, even smiling as I saw the swift but feeble light push back the gloom. I was in a deep basement, full of shapeless objects that extended farther than I could see. And I realized that to light my way out, I would have to burn every paper in the briefcase. I moved slowly off toward the darker blackness, lighting my way by these feeble torches. The next to go was Clifton's doll, but it burned so stubbornly that I reached inside the case for something else. Then, by the light of the smoke-sputtering doll, I opened a folded page. It was the anonymous letter, which burned so quickly that as it flamed, I hurriedly unfolded another. It was that slip upon which Jack had written my Brotherhood name. I could still smell Emma's perfume even in the dampness of the cellar. And now, seeing the handwriting of the two in the consuming flames, I burned my hand and slipped to my knees, staring. The handwriting was the same. Ha! I knelt there, stunned, watching the flames consume them. That he, or anyone at that late date, could have named me and set me running with one and the same stroke of the pen was too much. Suddenly, I began to scream, getting up in the darkness and plunging wildly about, bumping against walls, scattering coal, and in my anger, extinguishing my feeble light. But still whirling on in the blackness, knocking against the rough walls of a narrow passage, banging my head and cursing, I stumbled down and plunged against some kind of partition and sailed headlong, coughing and sneezing into another dimensionless room, where I continued to roll about on the floor in my outrage. How long this kept up, I do not know. It might have been days, weeks. I lost all sense of time. And
and every time I paused to rest, the outrage revived and I went off again. Then finally, when I could barely move, something seemed to say, "That's enough, don't kill yourself. You've run enough. You're through with them." At last. And I collapsed, face forward, and lay there beyond the point of exhaustion, too tired to close my eyes. It was a state neither of dreaming nor of waking, but somewhere in between, in which I was caught like True Blood's jaybird that Yellow Jackets had paralyzed in every part but his eyes. But somehow the floor had now turned to sand, and the darkness to light, and I lay the prisoner of a group consisting of Jack and old Emerson and Bledsoe and Norton and Ross and the school superintendent and a number of others whom I failed to recognize, but all of whom had run me, who now pressed around me as I lay beside a river of black water, near where an armored bridge arched sharply away to where I could not see. And I was protesting their holding me, and they were demanding that I return to them and were annoyed with my refusal. "No," I said, "I'm through with all your illusions and lies. I'm through running." "Not quite," Jack said above the other's angry demands. "But you soon will be, unless you return. Refuse and we'll free you of your illusions, all right." "No, thank you. I'll free myself," I said, struggling to rise from the cutting sand. But now they came forward with a knife, holding me. And I felt the bright red pain, and they took the two bloody blobs and cast them over the bridge. And out of my anguish I saw them curve up and catch beneath the apex of the curving arch of the bridge to hang there, dripping down through the sunlight into the dark red water. And while the others laughed before my pain-sharpened eyes, the whole world was slowly turning red. "Now you're free of illusions," Jack said, pointing to my seed wasting upon the air. "How does it feel to be free of one's illusions?" And I looked up through a pane so intense now that the air seemed to roar with the clanging of metal, hearing, "How does it feel to be free of illusion?" And now I answered, "Painful and empty," as I saw a glittering butterfly circle three times around my blood-red parts up there beneath the bridge's high arch. "But look," I said, pointing. And they looked and laughed. And suddenly, seeing their satisfied faces and understanding, I gave a Bledsoe laugh, startling them. And Jack came forward, curious. "Why do you laugh?" he said. "Because at a price I now see that which I couldn't see," I said. "What does he think he sees?" they said. And Jack came closer, threatening, and I laughed. "I'm not afraid now," I said, "but if you'll look, you'll see it's not invisible." "See what?" they said. "That there hang not only my generations wasting upon the water." And now the pain welled up and I could no longer see them. "But what? Go on," they said. "But your sun, yes? And your moon? He's crazy. Your world." "I knew he was a mystic idealist," Tobit said. "Still," I said, "there's your universe. And that drip-drop upon the water you hear is all the history you've made, all you're going to make. Now, laugh, you scientists. Let's hear you laugh." And high above me now, the bridge seemed to move off to where I could not see, striding like a robot, an iron man whose iron legs clanged doomfully as it moved. And then I struggled up, full of sorrow and pain, shouting, "No! No! We must stop him!" And I awoke in the blackness. Fully awake now, I simply lay there as though paralyzed. I could think of nothing else to do. Later, I would try to find my way out, but now I could only lie on the floor, reliving the dream. All their faces were so vivid that they seemed to stand before me beneath a spotlight. They were all up there somewhere, making a mess of the world. Well, let them. I was through, and in spite of the dream, I was whole. And now I realized that I couldn't return to Mary's or to any part of my old life. I could approach it only from the outside. And I had been as invisible to Mary as I had been to the Brotherhood. No, couldn't return to Mary's or to the campus or to the Brotherhood or home. I could only move ahead or stay here, underground. So, I would stay here until I was chased out. Here, at least, I could try to think things out in peace, or, if not in peace, in quiet. I would take up residence underground. The end was in the beginning. So there you have all of it that's important. Or at least, you almost have it. I'm an invisible man, and it placed me in a hole, or showed me the hole I was in, if you will, and I reluctantly accepted the fact. What else could I have done? Once you get used to it, reality is as irresistible as a club, and I was clubbed into the cellar before I caught the hint. Perhaps that's the way it had to be. I don't know. Nor do I know whether accepting the lesson has placed me in the rear or in the avant-garde. That, perhaps, is a lesson for history. And I'll leave such decisions to Jack and his ilk while I try belatedly to study the lesson of my own life. Let me be honest with you. A feat which, by the way, I find of the utmost difficulty. When one is invisible, he finds such problems as good and evil, honesty and dishonesty, of such shifting shapes that he confuses one with the other, depending upon who happens to be looking through him at the time. Well, now I've been trying to look through myself, and there's a risk in it. I was never more hated than when I tried to be honest, or when, even as just now, I've tried to articulate exactly what I felt to be the truth. No one was satisfied, not even I. On the other hand, I've never been more loved and appreciated than when I tried to justify and affirm someone's mistaken beliefs, or when I've tried to give my friends the incorrect, absurd answers they wished to hear. In my presence, they could talk and agree with themselves. The world was nailed down, and they loved it. They received a feeling of security. But here was the rub. Too often, in order to justify them, I had to take myself by the throat and choke myself until my eyes bulged and my tongue hung out and wagged like the door of an empty house in a high wind. Oh, yes, it made them happy and it made me sick. So I became ill of affirmation, of saying yes against the naysaying of my stomach, not to mention my brain. There is, by the way, an area in which a man's feelings are more rational than his mind. And it is precisely in that area that his will is pulled in several directions at the same time. You might sneer at this, but I know now. I was pulled this way and that for longer than I can remember, and my problem was that I always tried to go in everyone's way but my own. I've always been called one thing and then another while no one really wished to hear what I called myself. So after years of trying to adopt the opinions of others, I finally rebelled. I am an invisible man. Thus I have come a long way and returned and boomeranged a long way from the point in society toward which I originally aspired. So I took to the cellar. I hibernated. I got away from it all. But that wasn't enough. I couldn't be still even in hibernation, because, damn it, there's the mind. The mind wouldn't let me rest. Gin, jazz, and dreams were not enough. Books were not enough. My belated appreciation of the crude joke that had kept me running was not enough. And my mind revolved again and again back to my grandfather. And despite the farce that ended my attempt to say yes to Brotherhood, I'm still plagued by his deathbed advice. Perhaps he hid his meaning deeper than I thought. Perhaps his anger threw me off. I can't decide. Could he have meant... Hell, he must have meant the principle. That we were to affirm the principle on which the country was built and not the men, or at least not the men who did the violence. Did he mean say yes because he knew that the principle was greater than the men, greater than the numbers and the vicious power and all the methods used to corrupt its name? did he mean to affirm the principle which they themselves had dreamed into being out of the chaos and darkness of the feudal past, and which they had violated and compromised to the point of absurdity even in their own corrupt minds? Or did he mean that we had to take responsibility for all of it, for the men as well as the principle, because we were the heirs who must use the principle because no other fitted our needs? Not for the power or the vindication, but because we, with the given circumstance of our origin, could only thus find transcendence. Was it that we most of all, had to affirm the principle, the plan in whose name we had been brutalized and sacrificed, not because we would always be weak or because we were afraid or opportunistic, but because we were older than they, in the sense of what it took to live in the world with others, and because they had exhausted in us some, not much, but some, of the human greed and smallness, yes, and the fear and superstition that had kept them running? Oh, yes, they were running too, running all over themselves. Or was it, did he mean that we should affirm the principle because we, through no fault of our own, were linked to all the others in the loud, clamoring, semi-visible world, that world seen only as a fertile field for exploitation by Jack and his kind, and with condescension by Norton and his, who were tired of being the mere pawns in the feudal game of making history? Had he seen that for these two, we had to say yes to the principle, lest they turn upon us to destroy both it and us? Agree 'em to death and destruction, Grandfather had advised. Hell, weren't they their own death and their own destruction, except as the principle lived in them and in us? And here's the cream of the joke. Weren't we part of them as well as apart from them, and subject to die when they died? Ah, I can't figure it out. It escapes me. But what do I really want, I've asked myself. Certainly not the freedom of a Reinhardt or the power of a Jack, nor simply the freedom not to run. No, but the next step I couldn't make, so I've remained in the hole. I'm not blaming anyone for this state of affairs, mind you, nor merely crying mea culpa. The fact is that you carry part of your sickness within you, at least I do as an invisible man. I carried my sickness, and though for a long time I tried to place it in the outside world, the attempt to write it down shows me that at least half of it lay within me. It came upon me slowly, like the strange disease that affects those black men whom you see turning slowly from black to albino, their pigment disappearing as under the radiation of some cruel, invisible ray. You go along for years knowing something is wrong, then suddenly you discover that you're as transparent as air. At first you tell yourself that it's all a dirty joke or that it's due to the political situation, but deep down you come to suspect that you're yourself to blame. And you stand naked and shivering before the millions of eyes who look through you unseeingly. That is the real soul sickness, the spear in the side, the drag by the neck through the mob-angry town, the grand inquisition, the embrace of the maiden, the rip in the belly with the guts spilling out, the trip to the chamber with the deadly gas that ends in the oven so hygienically clean, only it's worse because you continue stupidly to live. But live you must, and you can either make passive love to your sickness or burn it out and go on to the next conflicting phase. Yes, but what is the next phase? How often have I tried to find it? Over and over again I've gone up above to seek it out. For like almost everyone else in the country, I started out with my share of optimism. I believed in hard work and progress and action, but now, after first being for society and then against it, I assign myself no rank or any limit, and such an attitude is very much against the trend of the times. But my world has become one of infinite possibilities. What a phrase. Still, it's a good phrase and a good view of life, and a man shouldn't accept any other. That much I've learned underground. Until some gang succeeds in putting the world in a straitjacket, its definition is possibility. Step outside the narrow borders of what men call reality, and you step into chaos. Ask Reinhardt, he's a master of it. Or imagination. That, too, I've learned in the cellar. and not by deadening my sense of perception. I'm invisible, not blind. No, indeed, the world is just as concrete, ornery, vile, and sublimely wonderful as before. Only now I better understand my relation to it and it to me. I've come a long way from those days when, full of illusion, I lived a public life and attempted to function under the assumption that the world was solid and all the relationships therein. Now I know men are different and that all life is divided and that only in division is there true health. Hence, again, I have stayed in my hole because up above there's an increasing passion to make men conform to a pattern. Just as in my nightmare, Jack and the boys are waiting with their knives, looking for the slightest excuse to, well, to ball the jack. And I do not refer to the old dance step, although what they're doing is making the old eagle rock dangerously. Whence all this passion toward conformity, anyway? Diversity is the word. Let man keep his many parts and you'll have no tyrant states. Why, if they follow this conformity business, they'll end up by forcing me, an invisible man, to become white, which is not a color, but the lack of one. Must I strive towards colorlessness? But seriously, and without snobbery, think of what the world would lose if that should happen. America is woven of many strands. I would recognize them and let it remain so. It's winner take nothing. That is the great truth of our country or of any country. Life is to be lived, not controlled. And humanity is won by continuing to play in face of certain defeat. Our fate is to become one and yet many. This is not prophecy, but a description. Thus, one of the greatest jokes in the world is the spectacle of the whites busy escaping blackness and becoming blacker every day, and the blacks striving toward whiteness becoming quite dull and gray. None of us seems to know who he is or where he's going. Which reminds me of something that occurred the other day in the subway. At first, I saw only an old gentleman who, for the moment, was lost. I knew he was lost, for as I looked down the platform, I saw him approach several people and turn away without speaking. He's lost, I thought, and he'll keep coming until he sees me. Then he'll ask his direction. Maybe there's an embarrassment in it if he admits he's lost to a strange white man. Perhaps to lose a sense of where you are implies the danger of losing a sense of who you are. That must be it, I thought. To lose your direction is to lose your face. So here he comes to ask his direction from the lost, the invisible. Very well. I've learned to live without direction. Let him ask. But then, he was only a few feet away and I recognized him. It was Mr. Norton. Ha! The old gentleman was thinner and wrinkled now, but as dapper as ever. And seeing him made all the old life live in me for an instant, and I smiled with tear-stinging eyes. Then it was over, dead. And when he asked me how to get to Center Street, I regarded him with mixed feelings. "Don't you know me?" I said. "Should I?" he said. "You see me?" I said, watching him tensely. "Why, of course. Sir, do you know the way to Center Street?" So, the last time it was the Golden Day, now it's Center Street. "You've retrenched, sir, but don't you really know who I am?" "Young man, I'm in a hurry," he said, cupping a hand to his ear. "Why should I know you? Because I'm your destiny." "My destiny, did you say?" He gave me a puzzled stare, backing away. "Young man, are you well? Which train did you say I should take?" "I didn't say," I said, shaking my head. "Now, aren't you ashamed?"
"Ashamed?"
"Ashamed?" he said indignantly. I laughed, suddenly taken by the idea. "Because, Mr. Norton, if you don't know where you are, you probably don't know who you are. So you come to me out of shame. You are ashamed now, aren't you?" "Young man, I've lived too long in this world to be ashamed of anything. Are you lightheaded from hunger? How do you know my name?" "But I'm your destiny. I made you." Why shouldn't I know? I said, walking closer and seeing him back against a pillar. He looked around like a cornered animal. He thought I was mad. Don't be afraid, Mr. Norton, I said. There's a guard down the platform there. You're safe. Take any train. They all go to the Golden... But now an express had rolled up, and the old man was disappearing quite spryly inside one of its doors. I stood there laughing hysterically. I laughed all the way back to my hole. But after I had laughed, I was thrown back on my thoughts. How had it all happened? And I asked myself if it were only a joke, and I couldn't answer. Since then, I've sometimes been overcome with a passion to return into the heart of darkness across the Mason-Dixon line, but then I remind myself that the true darkness lies within my own mind, and the idea loses itself in the gloom. Still, the passion persists. Sometimes I feel the need to reaffirm all of it, the whole unhappy territory and all the things loved and unloved in it, for all of it is part of me. Till now, however, this is as far as I've ever gotten, for all life seen from the whole of invisibility is absurd. So why do I write torturing myself to put it down? Because in spite of myself, I've learned some things. Without the possibility of action, all knowledge comes to one labeled file and forget, and I can neither file nor forget. Nor will certain ideas forget me. They keep filing away at my lethargy, my complacency. Why should I be the one to dream this nightmare? Why should I be dedicated and set aside, yes, if not to at least tell a few people about it? There seems to be no escape. Here, I've set out to throw my anger into the world's face. But now that I've tried to put it all down, the old fascination with playing a role returns, and I'm drawn upward again, so that even before I finish, I failed. Maybe my anger is too heavy. Perhaps being a talker, I've used too many words. But I've failed. The very act of trying to put it all down has confused me and negated some of the anger and some of the bitterness. So it is that now I denounce and defend, or feel prepared to defend. I condemn and affirm, say no and say yes and say no. I denounce because, though implicated and partially responsible, I have been hurt to the point of abysmal pain, hurt to the point of invisibility. And I defend because, in spite of all, I find that I love. In order to get some of it down, I have to love. I sell you no phony forgiveness. I'm a desperate man. But too much of your life will be lost. Its meaning lost, unless you approach it as much through love as through hate. So I approach it through division. So I denounce and defend, I hate and I love. Perhaps that makes me a little bit as human as my grandfather. Once I thought my grandfather incapable of thoughts about humanity, but I was wrong. Why should an old slave use such a phrase as, this and this or this has made me more human, as I did in my arena speech? Hell, he never had any doubts about his humanity. That was left to his free offspring. He accepted his humanity just as he accepted the principle. It was his, and the principle lives on in all its human and absurd diversity. So now, having tried to put it down, I have disarmed myself in the process. You won't believe in my invisibility, and you'll fail to see how any principle that applies to you could apply to me. You'll fail to see it, even though death waits for both of us, if you don't. Nevertheless, the very disarmament has brought me to a decision. The hibernation is over. I must shake off the old skin and come up for breath. There's a stench in the air, which from this distance underground might be the smell either of death or of spring. I hope of spring. But don't let me trick you. There is a death in the smell of spring and in the smell of thee as in the smell of me. And if nothing else more, invisibility has taught my nose to classify the stenches of death. In going underground, I whipped it all, except the mind. The mind. The mind that has conceived a plan of living must never lose sight of the chaos against which that pattern was conceived. that goes for societies as well as for individuals. Thus, having tried to give pattern to the chaos which lives within the pattern of your certainties, I must come out, I must emerge. And there's still a conflict within me. With Louis Armstrong, one half of me says, open the window and let the foul air out, while the other says, it was good green corn before the harvest. Of course, Louis was kidding. He wouldn't have thrown old bad air out, because it would have broken up the music and the dance, when it was the good music that came from the bell of old bad air's horn that counted. Old bad air is still around with his music and his dancing and his diversity, and I'll be up and around with mine. And as I said before, a decision has been made. I'm shaking off the old skin, and I'll leave it here in the hole. I'm coming out. No less invisible without it, but coming out nevertheless. And I suppose it's damn well time. Even hibernations can be overdone, come to think of it. Perhaps that's my greatest social crime. I've overstayed my hibernation, since there's a possibility that even an invisible man has a socially responsible role to play. Ah, I can hear you say. So it was all a buildup to bore us with his buggy jiving. He only wanted us to listen to him rave. But only partially true. Being invisible and without substance, a disembodied voice, as it were, what else could I do? What else but try to tell you what was really happening when your eyes were looking through? And it is this which frightens me. Who knows but that on the lower frequencies, I speak for you.
We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Invisible Man by Ralph Ellison. Read for you by Joe Morton.
Context of White Supremacy. Ralph Ellison, Invisible Man, narrated by Joe Morton. All done. If you have thoughts, questions, final assessment of the text, please give us a jingle. The number 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. If you want to join the conversation but you don't want to use your phone, you can use the free VOPE line. It is linked at Black Talk Radio Network. If you need the address, it is tinytiny.cc/1race. Address again, tinytiny.cc/1race. That is the number one. When you enter that address, look on the left of the page. You'll see the link for the free VOPE line. Click that link. When you do so, it will open a small window on your screen. The first line, it is a drop-down menu. Select the number I just gave out, which again is 641-715-3640. The next line, it will ask for the code. That code again, 564-943. Final line, it will ask for a name. You can put in a real name, nickname. You can press random keys, whatever you're comfortable with. Once you get all that information entered, click the green button at the bottom. It'll connect you to the program. You should be able to hear us live. It is the same procedure. If you would like to participate, you'll see the dial pad on your screen. Press *61. I will see your hand on the switchboard, and we will add you to the line. That's it. The word responsibility featured prominently through the last segment. In fact, right before he gets to the end, when he's talking about overstaying his hibernation, he says there's there's a possibility that even an invisible man has a socially responsible role to play. What does that mean? So close to the end of the text and using the very same language that he used at the very beginning at the Battle Royal about social responsibility. Question again, what do we think he means? The sentence. Perhaps that's my greatest social crime. I've overstayed my hibernation since there's a possibility that even an invisible man has a socially responsible role to play. What does that mean? The last part. What could your socially responsible role be as an invisible man, woman? Folks who dialed in, if you have thoughts on that question, you have your own thoughts, questions, final assessment of absolutely fantastic book, feel free to chime in. Folks who have a hand up, proceed.
Yes, may I be heard?
Greetings, Mr. Demery Four.
Yes, greetings, Gus. Greetings to the other callers and listeners. I'll take a shot at your question first. It seems that that statement about social responsibility came at a time when he was discussing, although he was in a situation where he could actually had no power over the events that was happening to his life. Once he realized the situation, then he had a responsibility to let others know. Even if you can't do anything about it, if you were, bring some enlightenment to others, that would be your social responsibility, in my view. But I like to start out with the character Ross the Exhorter. I think a lot of his characters were dimensional in a way that they were different individuals, like the founder of the college was probably a combination of Booker T. Washington, George Washington Carver, and Frederick Douglass all rolled into one. I think that Ross the Exhorter, although was commonly believed that Marcus Garvey was the image that he was portraying, I guess Marcus Garvey was West Indian, Jamaican-born leader in Harlem during that time, so-called black nationalist. I think one of the interviews with Ellison later, he said that Garvey, that wasn't Garvey in his mind, but I guess the character could have been inspired by Garvey. And I found another individual called Ross, Ross Kabbalah. He was actually a Abyssinian leader, which I guess was Ethiopian, a chieftain that at one time commanded over 50,000 troops. And, Ethiopia, correct me if I'm wrong, I believe was the first black country to gain their independence from the white colonizers. And then Ross in the novel, when the guy was explaining what happened, had a shield and this lion's cloth over him, and he kept commanding. So this Ross Caballa was a commander, so which led me to believe that he could have been dimensional too. I want to break some of this up because I got quite a bit, but I want to get to when the narrator ran into the guys. It may go into a little on last week when he ran into Dupree and Schofield. He wondered what Jack would think about the guy Dupree. And, you know, to me, that shows some form of brainwashing, because it's like Jack is a little chip in his head. He keeps thinking about what would Jack do, what would Jack think. And Dupree, a misguided individual who is getting ready to burn down his own home, and I guess Lottie, the pregnant woman he was talking to, was his own wife. And because he made this statement about no more men will be born in this building. So it leads you to believe he, that was his own wife. And the problem, he made a quotation. It's a quotation. And my problem was that I always tried to go in everyone's way but my own. I have also been called one thing and then another, while no one really wished to hear what I call myself. So after years of trying to adopt the opinion of others, I finally rebelled. I am an invisible man. I'll cut my commentary in half. I got a feeling that a lot of people want to talk, but I'll come back again later. Gus, thanks for taking the call.
Much obliged, Mr. Demery Four. Appreciate the insight on the character Roz, definitely. Other folks who chimed in, if you have thoughts, questions, final assessment, if you have a hand up, proceed. Rob in Wisconsin. Greetings, sir.
Greetings. I think I heard a female speak up right after I did. I'm not sure.
I did as well, but I thought that was the automated female voice saying unmuted. Okay. I thought that's what that was.
Okay. So to attempt to answer the question, I think that the social responsibility to me means you are responsible as a person for the individual thoughts that dominate the mind. And what led me to that conclusion was when he was in the manhole, and the way he spoke about the mind and the way he went into the dreams, and also how he spoke about a white person becoming black and a black person becoming white. Overall, I'm still processing the last part of the commentary. I thought that he really did a fantastic job of just laying out what the whole book meant and the title, The Invisible Man. And The Invisible Man, to me, with this book, it's really personal, because I'm going through a situation where the injury that I'm experiencing is so horrific. The people that I'm most closest to act as if my injury is invisible, that they don't see it. Although when I leave the house, everyone that I talk to sees it, although they see me dragging my whole left side, and I see them watching my left side. The invisible man is very personal to me right now. And I'm Neil Milan. Thanks for checking the call, Gus.
Appreciate that, Rob, in Wisconsin. And definitely the best wishes for your health. That is always just the worst anytime that your health is compromised in any way, and particularly in a system of racism, white supremacy. There certainly is no sympathy or even often acknowledgement, recognition for a black person with any sort of physical ailment. Medical apartheid. Other folks that we have not heard from, if you have a hand up, questions, commentary, lines should be open. Proceed.
Hello.
Greetings, Jay in St. Louis.
Greetings, everybody. Thanks for giving me a chance to speak. I want to say first that this is, was a great book.
Jay, I'm sorry, sir. If you could, your volume was a little low. If you could either maybe speak closer to the microphone or raise your volume, either or.
Okay. Is that better?
Just, I guess, make sure you use lots of black self-respect, full volume, and we should be good.
Okay. Well, first, I think the end of the book really gave a great philosophical treatise, if you will, about social death. And I think it's in line with other kind of Africana theorists. So it gave me a lot to think about how within the end of the book, he was able to capture a lot of contemporary work by people like Calvin Warren about the social death, Frank Wilderson, who I know you've interviewed about the living death of blackness. So I think that was amazing. He was able to capture that during his time. Additionally, it made me think about the social responsibility a little bit more. There's this kind of ethical aspect to this whole treatise of invisibility that I think is very, very interesting. And I'm not sure I'm able to, you know, articulate it fully, but I think it's certainly a great point of emphasis for further thinking about it. And I wonder if his second book would have built on this in a particular fashion. That was my largest speculation about after reading this book, after thinking about the kind of existential solutions and ethical obligations it gives. Apart from that, it didn't seem to be a larger systemic critique. And I could be wrong in that. This is, you know, me just thinking about it. But I also thought the main point of emphasis for me, and this is the last thing I'll contribute, is that, you know, before this descent and this really growth into blackness, he has to burn all the papers. And so the first thing to do is disregard the papers, burn the papers. And I wanted to end it there. Thanks.
Significant moment indeed, the burning of the papers. Other folks that we have not heard from, if you have a hand up, any commentary you'd like to share, proceed. I reckon while folks are waiting, I do see other hands. Seems like there are other folks that had not shared. Maybe they are getting their thoughts together. I'll share a few comments and then I'll check and see if they're ready to share their thoughts. So we got midway through chapter 25 and then the epilogue. I guess that's one thing. The only critique that I would have of how this audiobook is presented, they do not announce the chapters. So I do think that that's important. Like the segment that we heard was the rest of chapter 25 and then epilogue. I think it would have been good for everybody, not just first time readers, to know where chapter 25 ended and then definitively where the epilogue began. I think that's an important break. Anyway, okay, so the first notes that I took from today this about the exchange at the beginning, and I think his the way that he writes the characters, like just the random scenes where he's talking to different black people in Harlem, like the scene at the beginning where they're talking about the so-called riot, and the guy says, "This has been some night. Ain't this been some night?" And he says, "It's about like the rest." And he says, "Why do you say that?" He says, "Because it's full of fucking and fighting and drinking and lying. Give me that bottle." I cracked up lots of humor throughout the text, but I said, in its own way, that reminds me of Mr. Fuller not being surprised about anything in the system of white supremacy, certainly not a so-called riot, not being surprised and, oh my gosh, I can't believe this happened. Nope. Pretty typical, what I would expect. No need for the alcohol, though. But yeah, I think the way that he writes the characters is just, it's amazing. He allows for there to be humor. He allows for it to make really important points. I think of the scene when he had on the disguise and people kept thinking that he was Roz, and he went in the bar and he was talking, I think it was Maceo, and he didn't recognize him. That was, I think, his friend. He didn't recognize him, and he asked him about the ribs, and then they almost got into like a big brawl. Like, just the way that he writes these characters and the way that they respond, and then certainly the way Joe Morton voiced all of these different individuals, like that just really stood out and added a whole nother layer to the text. And the critique of Brother, I was thinking that scene at the bar with Maceo, and where they got in the fight about the ribs and all, the critique of the term brother, where he would allow some really important points to come up with his interactions with just some of these random characters presented in the text. Let's see, next. Wow, the way, and it comes up, it's all throughout the text. It continues when he moves along and they're talking about Roz and what they saw. The way that is written, the way he's describing Roz being on this lion. I mean, that really going to Mr. Demery Ford's point, but Roz being on this lion with the shield. And I mean, just the way that it is written, and they go back and forth in between this scene of him confronting the enforcement officials. Again, rage, this character, I think there's so much of that. How many, I cannot think of a book that has more illustrations of black counter violence. So, I mean, how many books, is that in The Hate U Give? A black person, one black person, an army of one confronting enforcement officials. There's so many different scenes of black people counterviolence against whites in the text, but to have that presented in such a humorous, entertaining way, and then that pivots back to, oh yeah, and give me another taste there. Just incredibly woven text to put all of this together in such a witty and well-written, extraordinarily well-written manner. Let's see. I thought it was so significant when, so he's hearing all of this. He's kind of getting the play by play from some of the black people out on the corner. And he says, they were laughing outside the hedge and leaving. And I lay in a cramp wanting to laugh, and yet knowing that Roz was not funny, or not only funny, but dangerous as well. Wrong, but justified, crazy, and yet coldly sane. Why did they make it seem funny? Only funny question. I thought that was really important because I think I've seen parallel, at least in my view, my interpretation. It'd be great to hear others' thoughts. We have people that have not even spoken yet. At least in my interpretation, there's been so many of these incidents. Nobody should be surprised about a police shooting and then a subsequent upheaval, or however people want to label it. In 2014, when this happened in Ferguson, I remember by about the sixth or seventh day, there was a quote unquote protest, a march or what have you. And it looked more like a parade, like there was music and dancing and that sort of, like, it just didn't seem serious at all, you know, given the gravity of what was happening. I saw the same war. I talked about the same thing The situation in Chicago just over the past few days, they had a segment where they had like a drum circle and they were doing their chant in rhythm with the drum circle. VGQ to everyone for, you know, how they want to respond. Victims guaranteed qualified. However, and even these folks in the text here, VGQ, if they want to, you know, have a sip and just laugh and giggle about how all of this is happening. I mean, hey, it's a lot of that has happened for real in these situations too. But to have a system of racism, white supremacy, that's what this is about. Black death, enforcement officials killing a black person, and white terrorism in general, and it not really being processed in a serious manner. Like, I have seen that consistently where we're not really seriously like processing these events or what's happening, even when something extraordinarily serious is. We might even be talking about something that's very serious, talking about racism, but it's not being done in a serious manner. It's being done as though this is a comedy. I thought that, wow, I thought that was really, and I mean, wow, at least in my way of processing things, if I'm in error or people had a different assessment, that would be great. But he did ask a question. Why did they make it seem funny? Only, and he has only in italics, only funny. If folks have any thoughts on that scene or any of the folks that have not spoken at all, if you have any thoughts, questions, feel free.
May I be heard?
Greetings, Red in Nevada.
Hello. Thank you for allowing me to share. Hello, everyone. I know, like, at least for the last chapter, when the Invisible Man, he finally realized that the handwriting for that note from the beginning where he thought it was a warning or maybe some other possible victim, that's how I took it, telling him, you know, you better not get too ambitious or, you know, they'll cut you down. And then he realized that that was the same handwriting on the slip of paper where Jack wrote his name, his new name. I was truly shocked by that. And I definitely thought that that was really how racist they will play both sides and still just trying to I'm still not quite fully understand like how the letter even came to be. Like, it seemed like to me it would have been written by a victim. And I thought that that was definitely significant, how white people, they can, you know, really disguise themselves as us, as victims, as black people, non-white people, and then get that, you know, to turn it back on us. There's a couple other things, I guess, but I'll, the one other thing was that with the last chapter was actually towards the end where he said, and I now realize that I couldn't return to Mary's or to any part of my old life. I could approach it only from the outside. And I definitely feel like that's something that I feel now since I'm trying to be less confused. And, you know, just when he references Mary's, I feel like that's kind of reminiscent of me being around family members who may be, you know, more confused, and even other parts of my old life, you know, in years ago when I still had white friends and stuff like that, and knowing that that's impossible. But I definitely, I feel like I now really approach things, and I try to look at things in a counter racist view. And so I feel like maybe that's what he was referencing when he said that I can only approach it from the outside. The other thing in the epilogue, I know Rob had basically mentioned you and definitely feeling that part really speaking to him. And I feel the same way about certain parts, especially when the narrator spoke about always trying to go everyone else's way except for his own. And I felt like that way as well, sometimes even feeling maybe ornamental, not really having any sense of I guess value maybe, no matter who I'm around. I think the whole epilogue is really, really, really good. I think that it really just touches on different factors of racism, white supremacy, and how victims are affected by it. I like the part where he said that basically white people, they were a part of their own death and destruction. Definitely reminiscent to me with the whole opioid epidemic and how we are a part of them as well and maybe subject to die if they die. And if they control everything, they control all the resources. And then if they die, you know, if they have all the secrets, all the cures and everything, I kind of felt like that's kind of what it made me think about when, like, if they die, it's possible that we may die as well. Not necessarily saying that, you know, it's completely mutual, beneficial relationship, I guess. And I like the part where he said where he was, you know, conforming. If you had to conform to be white, definitely feel like that even speaks to contemporary reality. And I guess I'll leave it there. Thank you for allowing me to share.
Much obliged, Red in Nevada. I think that's really important about his revelation that the person who wrote the warning letter, so this is back in chapter 18, the letter advising him not to go too fast, that Brother Jack wrote this, and the cunning of racist man, racist woman. Now, at that point, now, if he's, you know, figured out that Brother Jack has done this, well, then, I mean, hey, last week we were talking about how does he connect the dots that the Brotherhood wanted a riot. I would say that goes a long way in terms of how calculating these racists have been. And just the letter, it's the very first page of chapter 18. This is advice from a friend who has been watching you closely. Do not go too fast. Keep working for the people. But remember that you are one of us, and do not forget, if you get too big, they will cut you down. You are from the South, and you know that this is a white man's world. So take a friendly advice and go easy so that you can keep on helping the colored people. They do not want you to go too fast and will cut you down if you do. Be smart. Brother Jack's words. Other folks that we've not heard from at all, if you have comments, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, yes. Hi. This is a DC wife and mom. I have not participated in any of the live reads up until this point. I actually have been listening in the archives. And I had to make a point of listening tonight because this was just a phenomenal text and something that I had been wanting to read for quite some time and had just managed to put it off and put it off. And I was just really glad and grateful that you guys decided to read this book. But like I said, I was unable to participate live, but I have been following along. And I just wanted to really call in to say thank you to everybody that has participated week after week, even though I was unable to, because this was a challenging read for me, mostly because I didn't follow along with the text. I do have the ebook, but I told myself that I could only listen to it if I went to the gym and worked out or went on a walk or, you know, did something, some sort of activity. That was the only way that I could listen. So I couldn't exactly follow along with the book, but that it really helped to listen with the group and to have such really thoughtful comments from people and really great questions to follow along with the text, because it really did drive a lot of points home for me. And I don't know, I guess I'm just not that type of thinker where I really literally have to read something and possibly even listen to it at the same time to really get it. So hearing people talk about it, and especially this group that had so many really insightful things to contribute, I I was really so grateful to everyone. So thank you to you, Gus, and to everyone that participated and gave such great feedback, because this is certainly a text that I believe requires really deep analysis, because it is, it's just so, so worthwhile. And it's something that I certainly have to read again, actually physically read again. Like everyone said, Joe Morton did a fantastic job reading this. He made listening to it really so much better, and really could, you know, paint that picture for you. So that he was really wonderful to hear. And I think that's all I really have to contribute at this point. I just wanted to say thank you to everyone. One thing I would say, though, too, is for future book clubs, because I can't always listen live, so I do the archives. And if anybody is unable to participate, I think Gus has promoted Mr. H. Fox online before. He actually does, I just found this out, so maybe I'm late to the game with this, but... he does actually have playlists of the books. So there's been a few that I have sort of flagged that I want to go back and listen to. So you don't actually, if you're listening on iTunes or some other platform, you don't actually have to try to scroll and find each chapter. He seems to have them all really lumped together in a really nice way, not just the audiobooks, but I think some other subjects as well. I think like cinema, if all the programs they have talked about, movies and, you know, some other kind of subject matters that he's grouped them. So that's a really nice way, if you've missed out on some of the book clubs, which I have, it's a really nice way to get it all in one place. With that, I'll mute myself, but thank you again, everyone. I really appreciate everybody's really thoughtful feedback on the book.
Much obliged, DMV area listener. Mr. Fox, YouTube channel. Great efforts contributing, making it more accessible for folks to access the content. Lots, I guess we have, let's see, 6 years of book club content. We have been reading a lot over the last 6 years. Per Dr. Welsing, she said that this was something that she said would be highly beneficial. We've covered a lot of subject matter. And this book is definitely worth, you know, many reads. I will be looking forward to the next time that I read the text. But I always learn something. It's one of those books that I think every time you read it, even if, you know, you read it 10 times, 20 times, I think you'll still learn something every time that you read it. Other folks, people that we've not heard from at all, if you have commentary, proceed.
Hello. Go ahead now.
Ivy is yielding the floor, so the caller at 9400, did you have commentary, ma'am?
Yeah. First off, I like to say this is a very good book. I haven't finished reading it, and I just looked on and found out you guys today was the last day. I was very, very excited I didn't finish reading it, but I just wanted to say just a few things. One, in the beginning, did you guys notice when they were talking about the guy who was speaking with the Jamaican accent in the beginning, in the first chapters, was that Garvey? That was one question I had. And I know that's going back, way back, but the other thing was I wanted to know was, do you guys notice that lately, will you hear a lot of the anti-Black women rhetoric on the YouTube? A lot of the same things are being applied from these hateful Black males to African American women. It's the same hate that you see that white people are applying to us that these Black males are now applying to the Black women. And that was one thing that I noticed. And then the other thing that I noticed was at one point where the when there was an explosion, the guy didn't know his name, even though these two things are not connected whatsoever. It reminded me of like Kunta Kinte, where they try to, it was to me a symbolic way of people trying to separate, you know, that his name is being separated from him, so his history and everything is being separated from him. But this time, even though it was a victim who was doing it, who had I think the old man caused the actual explosion. And I feel like it was a victim that was doing it. So just in general, what do you guys think about when the victims, other victims are causing him harm, especially in the beginning of the book? What do people think about that? I haven't really heard you guys really talk about that. I know you guys are saying that he was putting his anger towards the victims instead of the white supremacists. But I don't hear about the victims doing things to him. What did anybody think about that? Or what's your reasoning? Or what is, I don't know, I guess what's the codified way that the guy should have responded? Like, if a person is right now in the present and something like this is happening, what is the codified response that somebody should have? And then the last thing was, I feel like with regards to victims doing things to the protagonist, it kind of reminds me like the victims are not like we are, currently we have this group of black people called the Boule, and they do the beating of white people. And I feel like you have the people are like, they, even though they're not in these fraternities and sororities where the Boule comes from, that they're participating in white supremacy on the behalf of white supremacists. That's what I think. And I just wanted to know what anybody else think. And then lastly, are you guys going to, have you guys ever done a book with talking about, I think there was a lady, her name is Ida B. Wells. Have you guys ever did that book, or are you guys ever considering doing that book? And thank you. I'll listen off air and I'll mute myself.
Yes, ma'am. Much obliged. We have not done Ida B. Wells, a book that she wrote, or any of the books that are written about her, any of the biographies on the book club, although that has been suggested. I know one of the books that was suggested is very good, but it's very, very long, which we're probably way against it being on the book club. Victims Guaranteed Qualified, VGQ, certainly you, Ralph Ellison, anyone is qualified to take any position that they do on the system of white supremacy. I have concluded that there is no such thing, or even if there is a quote-unquote boule, they are subject to racist man, racist woman, and I do not make any distinctions. Once I figure out a person is non-white, they're subject to racist man, racist woman. That is the only classification that I am worried about. I've concluded that non-white people find lots of different ways to take our focus off of the problem, where we end up doing a lot of complaining and focusing our frustrations on individuals that do not have any power over our lives. And I have concluded that no non-white person has direct power over any other non-white person, period. Your problems, the people that are most to blame, racist man, racist woman, racist child. That's my view. Folks can have their own assessment. I don't recall the Boule being in this text. The YouTubers, I'm not going to address that because that has nothing to do with Invisible Man. The assessment about how the other victims treat the protagonist in the text. Think Lucius Brockway in Liberty Paint Factory, the explosion, where even before that, they get into a brawl. I mean, it's a whole lot of conflict between them two before he purposely has the detonation that ends up knocking out the main character. Dr. Bledsoe kicking him out of the school. I mean, there's a lot of foul treatment. I think two different black people make him, or the one black female demands that he go in the trash to dig out the Jolly Nigger Bank. There's lots of mystery. And he is kind of rude to a lot of black people as well, early in the text, at least the way that he talks about many of the black people that he sees throughout the text. I think there's a lot of that in the text. There's a lot of that in the system of racism, white supremacy. At least that's my assessment of it, in terms of black people mistreating other black. In fact, that's kind of why I was saying with the quote unquote boule, that's how we get trained to focus a lot of our frustration on other black people. This text opened with the battle royal, black people fighting other black people for the entertainment of whites. That's how this book started. I submit that that's done all the time in the system of white supremacy. Try to minimize that as much as we can, minimizing conflict. That's something that I suggest. With some of the situations in the book where the protagonist is being mistreated by another black person, it would be difficult to suggest if someone is, you know, trying to detonate an explosion against you. I don't have a ready-made code for that. Now, specifically workplace racism, we talked about that yesterday. If it's a non-white person mistreating you on the job, Lucius Brockway, being rude or nasty, we talked about that yesterday. Workplace racism gave specific concrete suggestions, electronic communications, and that sort of thing. They didn't have that back in 1950s when this book was written, but we just talked about that. The school situation would be a bit different. Like, some of these situations are kind of hypothetical to deal with. I doubt you would have 2018 a black person shaking a slave shackle at you because you drove a white man to a bar. Like, it would be difficult to think that that's a legitimate situation. But a lot of these, minimizing contact and just watching what you say to other black people. But even remember at the men's house before he went to stay at Mary's, he picked up the spittoon and dumped it on the black person's head because he thought it was Dr. Norton. There's a lot of black people mistreating other black people in the text. That's big time glorified. At the beginning, I think you asked if the character that was speaking Jamaican was Marcus Garvey. I'm not sure if you meant like the very first chapter of the text. I don't think that could have been a reference to Marcus Garvey. I think the very beginning of the book is like the battle royal and the prologue where he's talking. So I'm not sure if you're talking about Roz specifically. Could be. I think Mr. Demery Ford gave some great commentary on that and referenced an interview where apparently Mr. Ellison said that he did not conceptualize Roz as being connected to Marcus Garvey, although he could see how that would fit. But yeah, did that answer all of your questions?
Yeah, but that's great, and thank you for that. And one thing that it was, I guess it was in the beginning when he had first got to New York, and there was a guy who was on a street corner.
Oh, that was Roz. Okay, that was Roz.
Okay, that's what that was. And he was with a Jamaican accent, that guy?
That was Roz.
Okay. And then and then what I was saying was that, of course, that, you know, I'm saying the same kinds of things happen today, even though you're not going to have the precise situations. You will have the same, you know, general situations where victims are victimizing victims, essentially. And because I had I just see it right now. Because the reason why this book rang so true with me at this point is because I'm kind of going through some things like this at work. And it's a multitude of victims. The most they're non-black, non-white, and white people. And I'm in a position where you know, they're trying to stop. You know, they're working together to stop a couple of us non-black people from promoting. And that's the portion of it. And then the other question that I had was, I guess this was really a good book. I always wanted to read it. I'm very happy that it was presented because some of it was a little difficult for me. And having the person narrate who did help a great deal for me. And it was the guy who read the book was absolutely superb. And I think that's about it, but I'm just so happy that you guys did it. I'm glad that I got home in time to chime in. That's it. I'll mute. If I have anything else, if you don't mind, I'll come back. But I'll mute myself. Thank you so much. Bye.
Yes, ma'am. Glad you were able to participate. I did hear that from a few folks before we even did pick this book, when I just announced that we were going to read this, and throughout, people who either they said they had tried to read this book before, they read this book before, or they had not read this book, but they wanted to and they did not because whatever reason, it's not the shortest book. I don't think it's super. I mean, you know, 13 sessions, we're done. We've had much longer books. It's not the longest book, but it's not exactly short. And parts of it are challenging to read. You have to kind of keep reference points, the things that you read at the very beginning of the book all the way to the end. And, you know, it's not the easiest book. So I'm glad if there were people who, you know, felt that this was kind of a helpful way to read the book, or if motivation, I heard some people had said that as well, that this, again, it's not the shortest book. People, I guess, to have some motivation, and certainly Joe Morton, phenomenal job, can't be overstated, phenomenal effort with the text. The female caller, if you're having those issues, workplace racism, definitely chime in. That way we could just get specifics about what you're dealing with, and, you know, folks who would be probably happy, myself included, to offer any counter-racist suggestions. Thursdays, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. We'll be here next Thursday. Let us know, or you can email, and I would be happy to read it on the air, and then people can offer their thoughts, analysis, suggestions. Ivy, much obliged for yielding the platform. Did you have thoughts, ma'am?
Yes, sir. Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers and listeners on the line. I'm just pulling up my notes here. I got the. First, I want to say that the commentary tonight has been absolutely outstanding, including yours, Gus. I want to thank you, Gus, for just even this program and for this book, for picking this book, and for just having the book club, just period, and adding that to the program. It's just been, the program overall has been invaluable, and the book club has been invaluable. I like how he said that, how he made note of or pointed out about making him white, and I don't remember if he was talking about the brotherhood or just racists in general, and just like just racists in general who control the world, just us living in this in a world dominated by racism. I like how he noted his confusion, how he pointed that out when he talked about just the confusion that he had, and just like you said earlier, like his rage came out again. Like I think it might have been when he was dreaming. It seemed like he said he wanted to kill everybody that was around him, either harm them or kill them all. I think it was like Brother Jack and a whole bunch of people, and I think it was in the dream part. And about him, you know, going back to even his confusion, how he was just wrestling with responsibility. In this last segment, he was talking a lot about that, and he was like, you know, does it mean this? Does it mean this? Or does it mean this? And about the social responsibility, if I'm not mistaken, I could be wrong, but I thought somebody brought up that he was talking about. I believe it was Mr. Ford that he was talking about his social responsibility to make other people more aware of racism and just that problem that we have to solve. I think that's something that really resonated with me, and that's what it seems like to me that he was talking about, either in the epilogue or the last chapter when he mentioned social responsibility. About the narration, like, it's so true that his narration was just so incredible. Like, this book was incredibly well written, like you said, Gus, and even like Mimi said, she said it was thought-provoking, and so many people have just said so many different things about how well written this book was. And Joe Morton, like, he really did this book justice, like the how poetic it was, and just how diverse it was in terms of different moods. I mean, Joe Morton was really able to capture all of that and to present all of that. The pairing of this book and that narrator was just too perfect, and just probably the most incredible thing I've ever heard in terms of just bringing something to life. And the last thing that I wanted to say is that, man, I am so encouraged by everyone who spoke about how this book has presented a challenge for them, and especially Robin in Wisconsin, when he mentioned how he was still contemplating the end of it because it was just so deep, and I felt the same way. And there was actually so many other things that resonated with me that he said that I didn't even write them down because I didn't know what they meant, so I couldn't really offer any commentary on them. I just know that they were very deep and very profound. So I'm just, you know, so grateful for everybody being transparent about their struggles with this book, because me personally, I'm not an intellectual. So, you know, it's, you know, when it comes to like really deep stuff, I really have to, you know, go over and over again and, you know, things like that. And the last thing I just wanted to say is that, Gus, you know, I'm sorry that you are dealing with what you're dealing with in yoga class, and the bitterness and contempt for you and hostility, really, is what I want to say. And I just hope that you have as good a class as you can have tonight. And I hope that I wish the female caller the best, you know, in terms of the things that she's dealing with on her job. I know, just like you said, with workplace racism, people just offer incredible advice, and it's just really helpful. And I think they probably can help you. And that's all I had. And thanks, everyone. Thanks, Gus. I'll mute my line.
Just trying to get through today's session without being accused of molesting. We have to do more hands-on adjustments. So no accusations. Other folks that if you dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary, much obliged to Ivy. If you have commentary, anybody that we missed totally, you should speak now. Did we nab everybody? Didn't miss anybody? Anybody have a hand up that we missed totally? Well, great. I will get in, see if I have any more notes, and then we'll see if other folks, even if you've already shared, you can participate. It does seem like we have some hands that we missed, so I'll check on that again as well. Let me see where I left off at with my notes. Okay. So I'm still in chapter 25. He says, there was only one way to destroy them. I got up from behind the hedge in the waning moon, wet and shaken in the hot air, and started out looking for Jack. Still turned around in my direction, I moved into the street, listening to the distant sounds of the riot and seeing in my mind the image of two eyes in the bottom of a shattered glass. That rage coming through, I process this as he's looking to go and do some cutting on Jack. Jack only has the one eye. We had the scene with the Brotherhood where he took his eye fell out or whatever, but it ended up being in the jar. And he refers to him as being a cyclops, that he's going to go and cut out his other eyeball for retribution for all of this. The rage of Ralph Ellison coming through, in my opinion. Continuing. Nigger in the coal pile. The joke that I've heard is nigger in the wood pile, and I think some whites have gotten in trouble for saying that. I actually don't think I've ever heard nigger in the coal pile before, but right on. They call him a goddamn black nigger, son of a bitch. Just stood out. Most of the time, whites do not do that ring, like calling you the 50 names, like they just will call you nigger or whatever it is, and then go into the violence or whatever else. But the string, I guess they couldn't get to the violence. They were limited this time since they couldn't access him, and then they cover him up in the manhole, the symbolism even of him being trapped in a manhole. The symbolism of him after he's trapped in the manhole. He says, this is the way it's always been, only now I know it. Wow. Wow. Like, that is, what an assessment of the system of racism, white supremacy, stuck in a coal pile. And this is the way it's always been. I believe somebody does say greater confinement, the system of white supremacy. You are already in prison. You can only be placed in greater and greater and greater confinement. I think someone does explain all of this in that manner exactly. Let's see. You can't even see his eyes. I had that written down as well before they slammed the manhole cover on him. In a book, Invisible Man, you can't even see his eyes. Next. Great point. Red in Nevada about the letters Jack writing. Both of them whites are extraordinary ghost writers. The rage again suddenly. So this is after he's upset about figuring out that brother Jack had been the one who wrote the letter. And he says that he or anyone at that late date could have named me and set me running with one and the same stroke of the pen was too much. Suddenly, I began to scream, getting up in the darkness and plunging wildly about, bumping against walls, scattering coal, and in my anger, extinguishing my feeble light. Man, oh man. Ivy talked about that program on anger. That is one right there. That's what happens frequently when we get frustrated in the system of white supremacy. And as Dr. Welsing says, frequently, it's not us bumping into coal. It'll be us bumping into other black people and whacking other black people victims in our frustration about what whites are doing to us. But that is what, in fact, when he used the word bumping against walls, I think I said on this here book club, Invisible Man, maybe 2 weeks ago, Eat, Sleep, Wander, Bump, Mr. Neely Fuller Jr.'s concept. He's talked about it before. That's what happens in a system of white supremacy. You get confused black people, non-white people, who don't understand what racism is, how it works, and that's what they end up doing. Eat, sleep, wander, bump. You don't have any understanding of what your purpose for being on the planet is, what you're supposed to do, how you should organize your time, energy, life, except what racists tell us to do. And so you just end up eating, sleeping, wandering, and then bumping into things and or people, which causes conflict. That invisible, and I said that was Invisible Man, as he has been sent running by whites. Run here, run there, run here, run there, bump here, bump there, and getting in conflict with other black people here and there all along the way. That's pretty much the assessment of it. Let's see, continuing. Even I was surprised nobody mentioned that god-awful film Get Out and the dark space. Ellison doing this concept some 75 years earlier reminded me of that. He says, even paragraph down, he says, I continue to roll about on the floor in my outrage. Ellison being angry. How could we not be? System of white supremacy. He has this portion in italics as though this is all a dream sequence. He says, somehow the floor had turned to sand and the darkness to light. And I lay the prisoner of a group consisting of Jack and old Emerson and Bledsoe and Norton and Roz and the school superintendent. And a number of others whom I failed to recognize, but all of whom had run me. I think that happens a lot, even though I would submit the people that are doing the running are the whites. Dr. Bledsoe is not in charge of anything, nor is Roz in charge of anything. Victims in the system of white supremacy. This whole, which again, all of this is in italics, so I processed all of this as just being him a dream, because after the italics end, he says, I woke up in the blackness, still in the black space. So I take all of that as to be some sort of dream, like the book began. He has the dream sequence where he goes back and he talks to the slaves on the plantation about what freedom is, and the woman's sons get upset. They talked about how they killed the white slave master and all that, same thing. So he goes in this dream sequence, and the way I processed it, this is, no one talked about this, the way that I processed it, he says, he's talking about Brother Jack, he says, but now they came forward, I'll free you, and he says, I'll free myself. Now they came forward with a knife holding me, and I felt the bright red pain, and they took the two bloody blobs and cast them over the bridge, and out of my anguish I saw them carve up and catch beneath the apex of the curving arch of the bridge to hang there, dripping down through the sunlight into the dark red water, and while the others laughed before my pain-sharpened eyes, the whole world was slowly turning red. Now you're free of illusions, Jack said, pointing to my seed, wasting upon the air. How does it feel to be free of one's illusions? And I looked up through a pane so intense now the air seemed to roar with the clanging of metal, hearing how does it feel to be free of illusion. When I read this scene, now I've read this book a bunch of times talking about challenging. When I say a bunch of times, I think I'd forgotten. I think a software developer asked me how many times, and I don't remember. I know it's been at least 5, more than that at this point, I suspect. So I read this, and I thought he was in his dream here talking about his eyes. And it could be, because, I mean, there are references to carving out people's eyeballs in the book. Reading it again here, I'm thinking that this is the regular castration. I thought it could have been symbolically castration, but him talking about his eyes. But reading it again here, I think it is castration, because he did say, see, I think this is castration. But what do people make of this scene, this dream sequence, and what he, I mean, talk about challenging. How did people process? Did people even process this as a dream? What did people make of this portion? If you don't have the text, you can't see that all this is in italics.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes, sir. This is Jay in St. Louis.
I immediately thought of how that he said he looked up and he saw his ancestors, our ancestors, and the water dead. And with that reference and the water and looking beyond, as they were cutting him and he saw the deep red, I really thought about the kind of reference to Bakongo cosmograms and cosmology. It's an older concept in which water represents the realm of the dead. And it was very theological in that way and kind of quasi-religious, and a real reference to slavery and the death and the genocide of it. So I thought about that, but it also puzzled me why Ross was with the people who were castrating him. Because I think that castration point is important as well, because this is, I think, could be interpreted as a gendered explanation of racism, a particular orientation towards it. And I referenced Tommy Curry's phallicism last week, but the constant references to him as a beast and things like that, you know, I think it really does capture a gendered aspect of violence. And you referenced the manhole. But yeah, I hope that answers or helps, you know, other people think about it.
Absolutely. Jay in St. Louis, much obliged, sir. Other folks, any other thoughts on this section here? A dream sequence, kind of symbolic castration. At least that's what I'm thinking.
May I be heard? Go ahead, ma'am.
Thank you, Mr. Demery, for I'll be quick. I know that there was a lot of that dream sequence with the sand and the bridge and stuff. It was really hard for me to understand, so I will have to go back and reread it. But when referencing the seed, I thought it was, at least to me, maybe because I'm a Black female, but more along the lines of actually killing children, and you know, with the blood, the water, and everything like that. But I thought it was more of, you know, killing, you know, live children and not just, you know, the castration. But I could definitely be in error, and I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Much obliged. Mr. Demery Four.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, sir.
Yes, I'm happy you mentioned that part about the castration, because I had put a note on here, but correct me if I'm wrong, I believe that during the riot that the book mentioned, Black boys in a blonde wig, you know, which would symbolize emasculation, depriving a man of his male identity. And we know identity is a big part of this book. And the castration in the dream, or I'd say nightmare, but Mr. Norton is
removing his illusion, excuse me for that, but which turns out to be his testicles, and they're throwing them, you know, I guess over the bridge. They're dangling and going into the water. So I thought about that same thing. And also, the riot happened on the 4th of July, I believe. And it was actually a revolt against the victimization and the oppression that white people were exerting on them. But at the same time, the 4th of July is when whites celebrate freedom and independence. Mr. Norton wandering around, and the narrator, upon recognizing him, tells him that if you don't know where you are, you probably don't know who you are. So it probably had more of a meaning, unless an individual understands their own place in history, they can never hope to discover who they are themselves, who their own identity is. And that's one other thing I want. Oh, the references to the honey wagon. Those, when the beer drinking woman was on the milk wagon, and early in the book, they talked about the honey wagon, which is really a sewer wagon. And then we commonly think of America as the land of milk and honey, but he seemed to be saying that America for blacks is not a land of milk and honey, but a land of milk wagons and honey wagons. I'll mute my line, Gus. Thanks for taking the call.
Yes, sir, Mr. Demery Four. Did any other folks have thoughts they wanted to share on the section, this kind of dream castration sequence? Right on. Oh. Was that someone?
Go ahead, whoever spoke up.
No, I'll wait.
Okay. Gus, I wanted to ask you, was that the same one? Did he say something in there about how he wanted to harm everybody in the room?
In the dream sequence?
Yes.
I don't think so, because the dream sequence, I think he's... Yeah, I don't think so. Let's see. Yeah, I don't think that's in the dream sequence. Yeah, different. That's a different part. Different part of the text.
Oh, okay. Well, that was it. Thanks.
Was there a male caller who spoke up simultaneously that was going to comment on the section, or?
Yeah, James St. Louis. I wanted to echo that point about what Mr. Demery Ford pointed out about the water when he's being castrated, and then, you know, tying it in with the Bakongo kind of cosmology. Not only is the water the realm of death, but it's also the realm where the dead become reborn. And the fact that it was his testicles as well, he is being castrated, you know, just, and this, you know, the kind of cyclical notion of life and death, I think it does inspire his later takeaways at the end as well. So that's all I want to say about that dream part.
Gotcha. Much obliged. Much obliged. Granted, I'll see if other folks have thoughts. Wanted to, one, make sure I got in readers who wrote in commentary as well. One of our callers, he wrote in. He says this is his second read of the book during the last year. And he says the commentary provided by you all has been very helpful. Chapter 25, the protagonist realizes that the Brotherhood has been the ultimate instigator for the Harlem riot. Could this be the answer? Could this be what the committee had planned, the answer to why they'd surrendered our influence to Roz? Could see it now. See it clearly and in growing magnitude. It was not suicide, but murder. The committee had planned it, and I had helped, had been a tool just at the very moment I thought myself free by pretending I had indeed agreed, had made myself responsible, there's that word, for that huddled form lighted by flame and gunfire in the street. As per Neely Fuller, the racist white supremacists are always in charge. Number two, the symbolism of the lynched mannequins is interesting. Were all the mannequins white during this time period in Harlem? I suspect they were. Ellison may have been equating the victimization of black people with white women's plight. Not sure. Ahead of me, the body hung white, naked, and horribly feminine from a lamppost. I felt myself spin around with horror, and it was as though I had turned nightmarish somersault. I whirled, still moving by reflex, backtracking, and stopped now. There was another seven all hanging before a gutted storefront. Number three, the protagonist again encounters Roz, the destroyer. Roz goes on the attack against the protagonist. This represents to me the ideal or ultimate plan of racist white supremacists, which is to cause their victims to name call each other. Betrayer, Uncle Tom's, Boule, in my opinion, that would be name calling, because I've never heard someone say that I am a member of the Boule. In my opinion, using that term would be a form of name calling. Blame and ultimately destroy each other while the Brotherhood is downtown laughing at the trick they played. Number four, the protagonist progressively gains greater understanding about how he has been manipulated and used throughout the text, and comes to the conclusion that it is better that he be true to himself as opposed to the vision that others have for him to be. Number five, the use of a spear, a primitive weapon, by Roz may symbolize the relative impotence of non-white people when it comes to counterviolence against the police who are using guns, racist white supremacists. Number six, the protagonist goes underground. The briefcase and its contents play a large part of chapter 25. The protagonist carries it throughout the chapter. He eventually burns the objects in the briefcase in order that he may see. The protagonist also realizes that the handwriting of Brother Jack is on both the paper that Jack wrote his name on and the anonymous letter. Red talked about that. Number seven, during what I interpret as a dream passage, the protagonist hears, "How does it feel to be free of illusion?" And now I answered, "Painful and empty." This passage may suggest that as the protagonist gains greater clarity or becomes less confused, a price is paid. The journey is not necessarily fulfilling to the psyche. The protagonist awakens and realizes he cannot return to his old existence. He can only move ahead or remain underground. He decides to remain underground. From the epilogue, the protagonist resigns himself to remain underground and undergoes an internal dialogue regarding the meaning of his life and his invisibility. He said, "The problems that I always try to go in everyone's way but my own, I have also been called one thing and then another, while no one really wished to hear what I called myself." The protagonist also undergoes an internal dialogue regarding what grandfather's yes means. I'm not sure if the protagonist ever completely understands what grandfather meant. Ellison, from what little I have read, was still a believer in the concept that a more perfect union, as it embodies the American ideal, is achievable for blacks. The principle the protagonist is alluding to may be that the American ideal, in spite of racism, subjugation that Ellison experienced and witnessed, he still thought that ideals, principles, were achievable in America, as opposed to a black nationalism viewpoint represented by Roz. This may also be a reason why Ellison's work was criticized by black nationalists during the 1960s. Number three, Ellison reinforces the protagonist's encounter with Norton, the notion that his invisibility is a metaphor and not to be taken literally. "Don't you know me?" I said. "Should I?" he said. "You see me?" And I said, watching him tensely, "Why, of course." Number four, Ellison makes references to Conrad's short story, Heart of Darkness. Hooligans, white hooligans in Seattle. Sorry about that. Ellison makes reference to Conrad's, Joseph Conrad's short story, Heart of Darkness, which involves colonization and subjugation of the Africans in the Congo. The novel also involves the journey of the lead character, white male, by river. Ellison's continual reference to European literature is a major theme throughout the work. Absolutely. We've talked about Joseph Conrad's work on this broadcast. A number, it's come up on the book club more times than I can count. The ending passage has become one of my favorite lines from a novel that I have read in recent memory. Who knows but that on the lower frequencies, I speak for you. I agree with Dr. Kevorkian that this is analogous to what you do with the cows. Ellison's work is magnificent on many levels. It combines depth, subtlety, symbolism, and poetry in a way in which few novels have been able to combine. I think it embodies the essence of American history for both black and white Americans. The fact that it continues to resonate and speak to us, even though it's six decades old, speaks to Ellison's brilliance. Much obliged. Let's see. I still didn't get to all of my notes from the epilogue. Let's see. All right, so from the epilogue, things that I wrote down. When he says, I was never more hated than when I tried to be honest, or when even as just now, I've tried to articulate exactly what I felt to be truth, no one was satisfied, not even I. That, I think, is a very common experience for victims of white supremacy. The system's primary weapon is deception. Anyone will be despised, hated, and branded an enemy who attempts to reveal truth, especially if it is a black person, about racism. He says, I've never been more loved and appreciated than when I tried to justify and affirm someone's mistakes, beliefs, or when I tried to give my friends the incorrect, absurd answers they wished to hear. Man, that happens so frequently in the system of white supremacy. Again, run by deception and faulty concepts, illogic that is required to keep all of this going. Let's see. Oh, the metaphors that he invokes in writing all of this, just the brilliance of Ellison's writing. He says, too often in order to justify them, I had to take myself by the throat and choke myself until my eyes bulged and my tongue hung out and wagged like the door of an empty house in a high wind. Oh, yes, it made them happy and it made me sick. So I became ill of affirmation of saying yes against the naysaying of my stomach, not to mention my brain. Wow. What can I say? Wow, Ellison, best book I've ever read, Invisible Man. Let's see. Yeah, I think you all mentioned it, the section where he says, if they follow this conformity business, they'll end up forcing me, an invisible man, to become white, which is not a color, but the lack of one. Must I strive toward colorlessness? Even if you do that, you will still be mistreated. They trick us with these concepts. If you do this, if you do this, if you act white, quote unquote, whatever that means, that will not protect you from us practicing racism, white supremacy at all. Let's see. Yeah, I thought it was great as well. He even circles back, boomerangs Norton back in at the end as well, in at the train at the subway transportation hub of New York, to keep the metaphor going, and asking him for directions, no less. But I thought that was great. Perhaps to lose a sense of where you are implies the danger of losing a sense of who you are. I thought that was great as well. And then again, he says, maybe my anger is too heavy. Going down towards the conclusion, I thought that was really important. Again, the rage of Ralph Ellison, victim of white supremacy. I will pause here. Any other folks have thoughts, questions, something you didn't understand? Have we been talking crazy about anything? Call her at 6260. Did you have a commentary you wanted to share?
Oh, hi. This is Andrexomania. I didn't get an opportunity to read the book, actually read the book, but I have been listening to the full session of the audio book, this book study. And I just wanted to say I really enjoyed the book. I thought it was amazing. And thank you so much for, I've been reading, listening to a lot of your books on the archives also. Just got finished listening to, what was it? I think it was Elizabeth and Helen. And now
Elizabeth
I'm
and
listening
Hazel.
To, and Hazel. Yeah, I apologize for that. And now I'm listening to 12 Years a Slave. So I've gained so much. Yeah, I'm listening to that now. And I just downloaded it on a PDF just now from Google. So yeah. So whenever I have an opportunity to read it, I will. But there's so many books that I'm trying to read. So your brain does not cannot distinguish between when you listen to an audio book as opposed to reading it. It's basically the same thing. It processes the information the same way. I heard that from a psychologist. So yes, I read and I also listen to the audio books. And yeah, I just wanted to thank you for, just offering this forum, and I gained a lot of information and a whole lot of knowledge from listening to you guys. And now I'll mute my line. Thanks.
Indeed, much obliged. Draptomania, 12 Years a Slave. I hated the movie. The book was interesting to read, but wow, I hated that. Like really, really. Really, I remember we read the book when the film was released. Wow, I hated that movie. Software, codified software developer in Wisconsin. Did you have commentary, ma'am?
Yes. Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. I'm in my car, so I hope it's not too noisy in the background. But just a couple of things about the epilogue. I saw the whole, and I forgive me if I'm repeating something that somebody already said, but I saw the whole as sort of a analogy to blackness. It's something that you really can't get out of no matter what you try to do. And you just alluded this. You just alluded to this with this whole idea of becoming white and what that meant. So I saw the ad that, especially when he was burning these pieces of paper, he's forced to burn all these pieces of paper, but the one piece of paper he can't burn is the Sambo doll, unless I mistakenly read that. And I thought that was really interesting. Like, that's the one piece of paper that he could retain because that's the one thing that represented him in this larger system. I just want to say that I really enjoyed reading the book again. I haven't read it in almost two decades, so it was really very, very pleasant to read it. And again, as I said in the first session, great to read it when I was a little less confused about racism. I enjoyed everybody's commentary, and that's all I have for right now. Thanks for allowing me to share.
Yep, that is important. Clifton's Sambo doll was the only piece of paper that refused to burn. He says it burned so stubbornly that he had to get another piece of paper to do the job. The Sambo doll would not die. Appreciate the commentary, codified software developer. Did make sure we didn't miss anybody. Anybody that had a hand up that we've not heard from at all? Grand. Any of the other folks who dialed in, if you do have a hand up, even if we heard from you, did you have any other comments, questions, anything that was said that didn't make sense?
May I be heard?
Red in Nevada.
Yes, I definitely appreciate everyone else's commentary about the resurgence of Mr. Norton. I know I highlighted that, and I know it had been brought up on the cows before, how white people, they like to, or they don't feel as bad asking for help from other victims rather than asking for help from other suspected racists to kind of hide their weakness. And I know that was brought up in the book with the Mr. Norton segment, he says, so here he comes to ask his directions from the lost, the invisible. Very well, I learned to live without direction. But I definitely, and so that's what it reminded me of. And then also with the different, the burnings of the different pieces of paper, one of the things I didn't mention was that I feel like as you become, or at least with me, I feel like as I become less confused, the things that I thought were valuable don't hold the same worth as they did before. And I look at them as this is something that only will kind of hold me to the white supremacists. And that's what I kind of felt like when he was, you know, burning all of his things. With the burning of the Sambo Dar, like that refusal for it to burn, also, at least to me, it felt like there's still like that really ingrained self-hate or like really ingrained white supremacy that we are all taught. And maybe that's the reason why it was so stubborn to burn. And I know even now I really still question myself. I don't consider myself to know everything and know how to completely counter every little bit of racist thing or even the anti-blackness that I may feel towards myself. And I think that might have been, that's what I kind of took from the whole doll, not really wanting to burn that easily. And I'll beat my line. Thank you.
Great point about the doll and that anti-blackness. It can be especially stubborn to root out. Speaking for Gus T first and foremost, I've heard that from others as well. I know Pam and I have talked about that, racismws.com, Pam the Great. But yeah, I think that's a great point and even reminds me of Codified Software Developer's point about the him ending up in this coal pit manhole, that being a metaphor for not being able to escape the system of white supremacy and being a black person in that system and the all-encompassing nature of it at that point where he's totally submerged underground, no less, in his blackness. And even going back with that, the Jolly Nigger Bank that he can't get rid of. He tries to throw, he's made to pick it up repeatedly. Even other black people bring it back to him and demand that he hold on to the Jolly Nigger Bank. So, yeah, I think that's very important. You are the ghetto. All of it goes where you are in the system of white supremacy. Other folks have questions, comments they want to make sure they share.
Yes, may I be heard?
Mr. Demery Ford?
Yes, I had one last question. I was wondering if you or any of the callers could give some commentary on the significance of the leather briefcase. It's the only item that was with him the entire length of the novel, and he never lost it, and it carried those pieces of paper that he would accumulate during the book. So I guess the briefcase was given to him after the Battle of Royale, and he kept it until the end of the book. I'd like to know any significance or metaphors to that. Thank you.
That's a great point. That's a great point. I hadn't given any thought to the symbolism of this brief, and he's still so attached to it. I think someone was at last. Yeah, it was last week because it was during the riot when they were going to burn down the building, and I think he spilled some oil or maybe some gasoline or what have you on the briefcase. He dropped it. That was it. He dropped it going down the stairs. I think it might have even been Jay in St. Louis that commented about him dropping it and even had to take a moment to fight to try to clean, like even at this late date, like it still seemed to have such tremendous value to him. And most of the time, as it's been referenced in the text, it's been to transport these papers that have kept him running and deceived him mostly. And then the Jolly Nigger Bank and the Sambo, like that's what it's been used for. Yeah, that's one to ponder on, certainly. And it coming to him from the white men at the Battle Royal, and that's even got some connotations. Dr. Welsing, she talks a lot about the symbolism of boxing, and the boxing gloves used to be leather. I think this satchel is leather, I think it is, unless I'm wrong. This is a leather satchel briefcase, Mr. Demi-4, yes?
Yes, leather. Yeah. I thought it was like lambskin, something of that nature.
Okay, yeah, that's same ball, but some sort of carcass bagging. That reminded me of Dr. Welsing's theory that he has so attached to this carcass that has been given to him by these whites at the Battle Royal and becomes his kind of keepsake or item for his keepsakes throughout the text. Any thoughts on that from callers?
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
The first thing that I think about, especially when it was brought back up, is maybe it being like symbolics of the Bible. I know like older Bibles, they used to be like leather bound or whatever. And I feel like at least with me, that was one of the, you know, it's still something that I kind of fight with like religion. It was given to Black people, at least some people like to think it was given to us by the white supremacists. I know other people, they have their own ideas about at least Christianity. But I feel like with the Bible, it kind of justifies, well, you know what, this is all right to be, you know, treated this way, or it kind of is supposed to be our value system. So it kind of holds all those things, like, you know, with his, you know, the education and with, you know, kind of the respectability part of it. So that's what I think about it as. I could be in error, but I'm my line. Thank you.
Fascinating. Appreciate that, Red Nevada. Any other thoughts on this leather satchel, the significance? Allison, we'll leave you with a lot to think on, certainly. That's one I might even ask Dr. Kevorkian, see if he has any insight on the significance of the bag. Any other questions, thoughts folks wanted to get in on Mr. Demi-4's question or anything else from the text?
I'm going to have something to offer.
Jay in St. Louis.
I listened to an interview of Mr. Ellison speaking about his book earlier today. And he mentioned that he was an athlete earlier in his life. And while he maintained that a lot of the references to his life were not as clear-cut as most people may assume, I think that's one that I'm confident threading the needle there. So for the papers to follow him from the Battle Royale within this suitcase, I think the suitcase just represented the accumulation of things that have been collected by whatever kind of social group the main character is embodying, which ultimately I think is Blackness itself. And the fact that he burns them, I like that somebody brought up the Bible, but I also thought about like the Constitution, even in a political way. That seemed to be like the Bible of the country, and the letters from Brother Jack and everything like that. But along with the kind of racist memorabilia, I read the response Mr. Ellison gave last week, and he talked about how it was a discipline for the Negro, the words he used, to study himself. And so I think just carrying around that kind of racist memorabilia, the clock and the doll that was manipulated by Clifton, represents, I guess, points of departure for him to just immerse yourself in, you know, what seems to be the most repulsive representations, to really find the humanity as he does. He just plunges into the terror to find the light, if you will.
Fascinating. Grant, that's he left a lot of material to go back and check out to get like further insight on the text and his life, the athleticism. There's so many references to boxing in the text that that is not hard to believe. Any sort of connection, it seems like he has a real affinity to athleticism, and it seems like he probably watched a boxing match or two, maybe 10. Any other thoughts folks wanted to share, get in?
Can I be heard?
Software developer?
Yes. Thank you. I'm back at home with my book now, so I can look at my notes. At the beginning of the epilogue, when he says, when one is invisible, he finds such problems as good and evil, honesty and dishonesty of such shifting shapes that he confuses one with the other, depending upon who happens to be looking through him at the time. And I think that's the way it is with pretty much all victims of white supremacy. We all have this tendency to sort of have to go along to get along. And what may seem immoral to us at one point, when presented to us in a certain way by racist suspects, turns out, you know, we start to think that that's moral, or we start to think that up is down and down is up, because again, like you said, this is a system that's based primarily on deception. Also in the last chapter, I think it's chapter 25, where he says when he falls into the manhole, and the white males are asking him what he has in the briefcase, and he says, "Come on down, ha ha! I've had you in my briefcase all the time, and you didn't know me then, and can't see me now." And I thought it was really interesting. It reminded me of the scene, or of the scenes at the Liberty Paint Factory, where I believe Ellison is making it very clear that whiteness cannot exist without blackness. And again, it sort of alludes to that idea that all these pieces of memorabilia that he has in here, you know, this Jolly Nigger Bank and the Sambo doll and all this, you know, the leg chain from Brother Tarp, all these things really sort of represent whiteness in a sense, because without these things, without this sort of blackness, this black pathology, there can be no whiteness. So I thought that was interesting, too. And I want to go back to the question that you first asked at the beginning of the book club, or at the beginning of this book study, why do white people like this so much? And I don't remember if it was, I think it was Red who said this. She said, you know, and I'm paraphrasing, so Red, please, if I get it wrong, please forgive me. But she said white people seem to like it, but they don't seem to circulate it. As widely as they circulated something like The Hate U Give. And I think that's very interesting. I think I said this before, that sometimes white validation is used as a technique of neutralization. And there's a lot of very important lessons in this work that victims of white supremacy could use to hopefully bring about a system of justice. And it's not widely taught. I think I read this book when I was a very young adult, maybe college age, and I read it on my own. It was never taught to me, and I think most of the non-white people I know, and that includes non-white, non-black people, weren't taught this book. I think I've met maybe one other person who's read this book, and they read it in school, non-white Indian male. But other than that, it seems like sometimes white validation is used as a neutralization technique, and especially during the time where it was published and, you know, later on where you had this sort of black nationalism, quote-unquote radicalism, becoming very popular, anything that would be validated by whites would probably be seen as a problem. So that's all I have. Thanks so much.
Fascinating. Yeah, that is, I would encourage folks, even though we are done with the book, to kind of think about that. Why does this book have such appeal for whites? And I talked about that before, but I didn't have to read this book in school. I read it on my own. I do think it would be difficult to read this as like a high school text. I guess if we're talking reading in school, I would be thinking college, maybe, not high school or anything. I could not imagine reading this book and like grasping what's being discussed as a high school student. That would be kind of a bit much, but yeah, I will have to inquire about that. Black people who've read this text from now on, if they read it, and did they have to read it in school? Any other
comments folks wanted to make sure they got in, questions.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you for allowing me to speak once again, and to the codified software developer in Wisconsin. That's definitely what I said. So thank you for bringing that up, and that's still how I feel. But also, the book to me, it kind of makes me think about like the rise and fall of a victim who is showcased by Mr. Neely Fuller's term, someone who is propagated or, you know, made popular by the white supremacists as, you know, the example of what other Black people should be, and then, or, you know, given money to, you know, just to be anti-Black or what have you. So I honestly feel like it could be like, to me, it kind of makes me think about that, you know, especially with the whole, with Black people being in politics. Like, I know some Black people, they get really mad at some of the Black politicians, and it definitely makes me think about just certain things in the book, especially the relationship between Ross, the exhorter, and the protagonist. But it was really, you know, the white people, once again, you know, white people are the problem. They're the ones who completely changed the protagonist from the person that he could have actually been to what he was supposed to be. So that's kind of like my main overall assessment of the book. And I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Much obliged, Red in Nevada. Wow. Any other questions, gripes, things that stood out, or not gripes? Shouldn't be any gripes. I cannot imagine. I had my gripes about The Hate U Give. There should not be any gripes about this book. But if anybody, I guess you do have a gripe, you can feel free. If you have questions or things that stood out, feel free. Folks are satisfied.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, was that Ivy? Was that Ivy?
It was. Go ahead, Gus. I don't mean to interrupt you.
I was just going to give a preview of the next book.
Oh, wait. Go ahead.
Okie doke. The next book, I said Zora Neale Hurston. I think Princess and several other people. That was how this book got selected. I did not pick this book. Several listeners said, spearheaded by Princess, said we should read this text. Just came out. Barracoon, Barracoon, by Zora Neale Hurston. She wrote Their Eyes Were Watching God, which I have read. We did not read the book on the book club, but I have read that. So this book, I'm just reading the review from NPR, a little bit of it. Slave narratives tend to equally fascinate and appall. They can represent history, read in tooth and claw, or in the words of noted multiculturalist Lawrence W. Levine, a melange of accuracy and fantasy, of sensitivity and stereotype, of empathy and racism. The eye-opening, terrifying, and wonderful Barracoon, the story of the last Black cargo, a posthumous, previously unpublished nonfiction work by Zora Neale Hurston, demonstrates an intimacy and immediacy that some of those interview-based narratives lack. This early effort, completed before Hurston's fame peaked as an anthropologist and novelist, has the passion and freshness of a young person discovering her true métier. Barracoon, the word comes from the Spanish word for barracks, came about in 1927 when the then unknown Hurston was assigned a task by famed anthropologist France Boas, interviewing an 86-year-old former slave living in the tiny town of Plateau, Alabama. Oluwale Kosula, I think that's how you say it, I could be incorrect, also known by the slave name of Cujo Lewis, had a remarkable past. Raised to the age of 19 in West Africa, he was captured and brought to the United States as a captive on Clotilda, the fabled last ship ever to ply the waters of the transatlantic slave trade. The year was 1860, and importing slaves to the U.S. had been illegal for over half a century. Nonetheless, Kasula got snatched, enslaved for 5.5 years. He used his freedom after the Civil War to help found a community, Africatown, with his fellow survivors from Clotilda. Hurston returned to interview Kasula numerous times over a series of months. "My people in Afiki, you understand me, they not rich." He tells her, "That's the truth. I'm not going to tell you my folks they rich and come from high blood. Then when you go in the Afiki soil and see the people, they say, why Kasula over there in America soil tell folks he rich? I tell you like it is." Now that's right, ain't it? Hurston's use of vernacular might be a stumbling block for the modern reader, but it was the accepted professional approach of the day. John Lomax, director of the WPA project, instructed his interviewees, "I recommend that truth to idiom be paramount and the exact truth to pronunciation secondary." The reader who commits this to that vernacular is richly rewarded for persistence. Kasula recounts his capture by Dahomey warriors, with female warriors playing a large role. Transported below decks for weeks at a time, he and other men and women are naked, starved, terrified. A chilling passage concerns Kasula's new life in the U.S. "In nighttime, we cry, we say we born and raised to be free people, and now we slave. We don't know why we bring away from our country to work like this. It's strange to us." That is our next book, per the request of many listeners. I have not read this book, and it just came out this year, so this will be the second time that we are reading a relatively new book. This one published just a few months ago. The Hate U Give, unfortunately, was pretty new, and this will break up our streak. We have read consecutive fiction books back to nonfiction, which is typically what we would read. But I am excited to check this one out. I am not a fan of slave flicks and such, but we have read some pretty good books that dealt with slavery on the program. Edward Baptist, The Half Has Never Been Told. Wow, what a gem. Anyway, this is next up. Much obliged, Ivy. You all can nab a copy from the library. This one might be more difficult to nab since it's newer, but get cracking. You have a week to prepare. Ivy, did you want to share?
Yes, sir. Thinking about, well, first of all, I wanted to ask you, in the beginning, he was about to, the Invisible Man was about to kill a racist, and he regretted that he didn't?
He referenced himself as being irresponsible for not killing him. That was in the prologue.
Okay. Yeah, I think this is, you know, is an incredible book, as many of us, if not all of us, have said. But I also think that there are a lot of things in this book for white people to like. A lot of the things that he was going through, he didn't really, he could have just really done a lot of damage to races. He could have killed them, like we just spoke about, and they wouldn't have liked that. If he would have like killed Brother Jack and, you know, a bunch of other people, you know, white people, they wouldn't have liked that. And he seemed to be in some ways more confused about certain things. Just his, how can I put this? I want to say addiction to whites to a degree, where it just seemed like it was such a tragedy in his mind for him to upset Brother Jack or to be disassociated, you know, with the brotherhood of these, you know, these races. I think the Todd Clifton was the same way. And if not him, certainly Dr. Bledsoe, where because of Mr. Norton or whoever, you know, he mistreated the invisible man like very, very deeply, just because, you know, it seemed like he wanted to be closer to the white man. And just even how all the anti-blackness, I think white people, they like that. A lot of the anti-blackness that was in the book, from the Invisible Man himself and from a bunch of other people. And how even Roz seemed to be rebuked. He was like, he seemed to be kind of the less confused person, but he was kind of at odds with the Invisible Man. They had, you know, disagreements on how to, I guess, to solve the problem. And Roz could be looked at, I think, as more militant, which isn't a bad thing at all. I think even how the racist woman, how she mistreated him, the drunk one, who he got drunk with, or she was really the one getting drunk. And a lot of the things that that was said to him that were so disrespectful from Brother Jack and some other people. So I just think that, you know, there's a lot of, I guess, entertaining things for white people to be entertained by, and not that these things are in themselves entertaining, but they're entertaining to whites because they're terrorists. And so I just think that there was a lot of things for them to like about this book. And the last thing I wanted to say, I'm so grateful, like the Codify software developer yesterday, she was sharing her shortcomings, and she has done a lot of that, and I really appreciate that, and read that tonight as well about her anti-blackness, and so did you, Gus, and that's one of the things that I love about you so much, that you, as knowledgeable as you are about racism because you study it, you may disagree with that, but you know at least that you're perceived that way, and you do not like act like you know everything and act like you do everything right all the time. And I just want to tell you that when you do mention your shortcomings, they come off as very, very sincere. They don't come off as false humility at all. And so I just, you know, wanted to thank, you know, you guys for just, you know, being transparent and being real about your shortcomings, because that's just very, very encouraging, especially people who have been more confused for so long and are so recent when it comes to being less confused. And I just wanted to quickly say, in terms of that term, less confused, I think it can mean two things. I think it can mean kind of being less confused in general, and it can also mean being less confused than you were even yesterday. And I find out, seem like every day, and the more I listen to the cows, the archives and things like that, just how much more, just how confused I am. But that's all I wanted to say. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Gus. I mean,
much obliged, Ivy. Archives are available. Anybody else have a final thought they need to get in on the text? Almost done with the broadcast. Any final thoughts as we are all done with Invisible Man? Moving on, next Friday's Zora Neale Hurston. Anybody else?
Can I be heard?
Rob in Wisconsin.
I just had a question. I missed the title of the next text that was going to be read.
B-A-R-R-A-C-O-O-N. Barracoon. Zora Neale Hurston. Barracoon.
Can you, Neale Hurston?
Zora Neale Hurston.
Zora Neale Hurston. Okay, thank you.
Yes, sir. Grand. I will assume everybody is good. Always got to end. Always sad. I feel that when books that I have that are in my top 10, always a slight pang. You get to that last page. But there are other really good books. I have not read Zora Neale Hurston. So, you know, I will be going along first time with everywhere. I assume most of us will, because this book just came out. So unless we got some really fast readers who hit the recently published section of your library, I suspect we'll all be doing this one for the first time. So that will be a hoot. Looking forward to it next Friday, 8 p.m. East. Whoops, nope, still in teacher training. So we'll be at our earlier time, 7 p.m. Eastern, 4 p.m. Pacific. Almost done with teacher training, though. Anywho, thanks to everyone who participated. If you wrote in, if you listened to the archives, for calling in, everybody who was a part of the Invisible Man study session, it has been marvelous. Number one book, and reading it this time just affirmed why I've said for so long, yep, top five and absolutely best book that I've read. Phenomenal. I will be looking forward to the next time that I get to read the text. If you have questions or comments, feel free. You can drop an email. I'm going to email Dr. Kevorkian to ask him about the briefcase, significance of that, and I will report back what he had to share. I guess I'll end, since he did give a thought on Brother Restrum, his comment on Brother Restrum's name. I said I was going to add that at the end. He says, I'm not sure. He definitely exemplifies a kind of brotherhood mentality when he's resentful about the narrator's rising prominence, having his picture in a magazine, etc., that seems to, in Restrum's view, make the movement more about the individual and his personality rather than the group. He even accuses the narrator of wanting to be a dictator. I know one of the things that you emphasize on your program is that victims of racism need to be patient with one another and practice mutual respect. I think Ellison includes this episode with Restrum in part to talk about the dangers when victims of racism show disrespect to each other and even become resentful of one another's success. The name Restrum does seem significant. It contains the verb rest, W-R-E-S-T, as in to grab something, especially to grab something away from someone else. So it may have to do with the conflict that can come along with envy when two people are reaching for the same prize. They can try to grab it from one another rather than working together to the same goal. Dr. Kevorkian, I'm going to ask him about that bag. And I did ask him about the leg iron being used as a weapon. I will report back. With that, we will call it a broadcast, sadly. We'll be back next week, or before we even get to next week, we'll be here tomorrow for the compensatory call-in, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. I hope whites behave themselves in Seattle, and I'll be able to make it to the program without injury or problem. That'll be tomorrow. We'll review what's gone down the last 7 days on the plantation. If you have questions, problems, drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. Untiljustice@gmail.com. Much obliged again. If you're going to be out and about enjoying the sun, it's been lovely in Seattle for the last 10 days. Have a blast, but remain codified. Just because the sun is shining does not mean racists take a pause from terrorizing. Part of that codification should be remaining sober. I know Dr. Welsing would strongly encourage us, have your fun, but stay sober. Keep your brain computer, your body in great condition so that we can make the best possible decisions to keep ourselves safe under very dangerous conditions. If you're going to be out and about in a vehicle, driver or passenger, not only should we be sober, let's be buckled up every time. Let's do everything we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.